psychological warfare, as well as for intelligence and operations. I suggest that we discuss at an early board meeting the possible offensive or defensive utilization of these phenomena for psychological warfare purposes. Signed, Walter B. Smith, known as General Walter Bedell Smith, who at that time was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM's Politics Show. If you've been listening to the PRSC stream from 3 p.m. today, Richie Allen does his regular show right here on this stream every week. And that's Richie Allen at richieallen.co.uk and also on this stream from 3 o'clock on Fridays. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and Bristol-based geopolitical researcher Alan Brown. In the second part, Brexit as no deal looms, disaster or storm in a teacup. If there's no deal, whose fault is it going to be? As it looks increasingly likely. And also, President Macron, just over La Manche, the fascist state we were hearing about last week. Well, anti-Muslim laws being passed now are rather like the anti-Jewish laws being passed in 1930s Germany. All Muslims under surveillance and heavy manners are all blamed for the attacks that have been taking place over the last few years. And the dynamic duo of the world's most powerful men, we heard a bit from them last week, that's Klaus Schwab and the good old Henry Kissinger. Beautiful voices they both have, don't they? And also the Pentagon's use of artificial intelligence, as well as, funnily enough, at the same time, the CIA partnering with the tech giants like Google and Amazon, as if they hadn't always been in bed together. Some would say, actually, that those big tech giants were spawned out of the CIA and Microsoft. Also, the Gulf States all going along with the Israelis. And Harry and Meghan, I know Martin loves talking about the royal family, Harry and Meghan have it both ways. And also, the Duchy of Cornwall, too. Is the Duchy of Cornwall public, which is Prince Charles's estate, or private? Well, it seems it depends whatever suits Prince Charles at the time. Norman Baker has a new book out, the former MP who wrote a book about the death of Dr. David Kelly. Also, Roland Perry, the Australian journalist who spent a long time in London, on Victor Rothschild. Everyone gets accused of being anti-Semitic if they criticise the Rothschilds family. And Roland Perry did too when he brought his book out in the 1990s. I managed to track him down this week. Stalin's pet spy, Victor Rothschild, was in MI5 and in the city right the way through World War II and the Cold War. The man who made Israel. That's what Roland calls him, exposed in Roland's book, The Fifth Man. And the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. That was the title of an eschatology seminar that I took part in last weekend, organised by the Muslim think tank, which is Global Vision 2000. It brings together multi-faiths, monotheistic faiths and none, to examine this time the plandemic. So, let's begin, Martin, by, I suppose, have you been RTing this week? That's always a good place to start.
No, I haven't done anything for RT this week.
You haven't? Right, well, that's a shame. Okay, well, we'll start instead with Alan then. Alan, where are we on COVID-19 data?
Well, we started off not knowing much in March. We had previous virology models, but as it's gone on, it looks more and more proved that lockdowns don't work and masks are ineffective.
Okay, can you just, those two things, okay, why don't lockdowns work? What evidence have you got for that? Doing quite a lot of them, aren't they, around the world, not just here?
Well, the first study that I saw was by the University of East Anglia, which did a correlation between lockdowns per country and the number of per capita deaths, controlling for other variables, and they found only limited measures were effective in reducing per capita deaths.
But like, even surely a few people that are saved, that's worth it, isn't it?
Well, they found some because bear in mind there's also the COVID-19 deaths, but there's also deaths caused by the policy you're introducing, so it's a cost benefit analysis. And some policies like stay-at-home orders were actually associated with higher COVID-19 deaths.
Why is that?
Well, they didn't know, but you can theorise why this happened, but this is what the data showed, is that some policies like banning large gatherings early on were associated with lower COVID-19 deaths. Some, like stay-at-home doors, was associated with higher COVID-19 deaths.
Okay, Martin, this is quite interesting, isn't it? Because you had a whole load of measures brought in. It seemed that some were actually helping, some were not.
Well, obviously, we're still in the process of trying to assess which have been successful policies.
Why? I mean, eight months on, why are we still in the process? Actually, no, it's longer than that, isn't it? It's probably 9-10 months on almost.
Well, some countries have done very much better than others, there's no doubt about
it. I mean, why are we now still saying, oh, we still don't know what to do, all this time after, and the whole world dealing with this?
Well, different countries have adopted different policies, so in a way, you've got a series of experiments in what you might or might not do.
You've also got a problem, haven't you, that if a government adopts a specific policy that then starts to look as if it's been killing people, then they don't really want to admit it.
No, but some countries have actually got rid of the virus completely, and there's quite a lot of them.
I would dispute that. You can't. This is kind of what you call spurious correlation. It's kind of naive statistics. You cannot say, this happened, this policy change happened in this country compared to this country, and therefore the causal factor was lockdowns. This is nonsense. You can't say that. You have to control for other variables.
Sure.
And this is what some of these studies, like in the Lancet, in the BMJ, by University of East Anglia, there's about 20 studies now. There is no correlation between hard lockdown and limiting.
You've got
COVID-19
a basic
deaths.
Problem at the heart of this, haven't you? Which is that the virus doesn't thrive on spreading in the outside air and the outside world. It actually thrives inside. So we've got lots of people inside. It's likely to be passed around between those people. But if those people can only catch the virus from somewhere else if they're going out. Now, we didn't completely stop people going out, Alan. Maybe we should have actually locked people in their doors and had a very few going around delivering food parcels to everyone's doors. That would really be the only way to stop COVID spreading in people's houses.
But the problem is that there are various, I mean, the COVID plan B group that are kind of based in New Zealand. They were discussing why it was that lockdowns have been proven to be totally ineffective. And one, it's highly infectious. So you'd essentially have to lock everybody up and that would cause large amounts of deaths by itself. People not getting medical treatment. Cancer screens not being done, all the rest of it.
Well, I think it's probably a good time to talk about suicides because we've had the brother of Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, allegedly anyway, committing suicide, certainly died over the last couple of weeks. And that hasn't really been covered a lot. I don't know if you'd heard about that, Martin.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, well, and one of the reasons may be because the Mayor has been pushing very hard for the tightest type of lockdown, or at least he's not been pushing back, saying that we should be tier one or tier two. He's just been allowing them to basically do whatever they want, and of course that's not been all that popular here in Bristol. Most people seem to be wanting, you know, saying, well, why have we been singled out here in North Somerset and Bristol as the only people in tier three? The statistics don't necessarily seem to agree with that. So anyway, why are we in tier three? And it's very sad to hear about the Mayor's brother, or I think he's his half-brother, that's died over the last couple of weeks, allegedly suicide. That would be awful if it's been a consequence of these lockdowns.
Yes, I mean, there are problems because the Euromomo data on excess mortality does not seem to justify being in lockdown. We're in low excess mortality. We haven't really had any serious excess mortality.
Well, isn't that because everybody has died off earlier in the year? I mean, that's the people that might have been dying now have probably died earlier. Martin, this is a basic, the sort of way that most people would look at this is to say, well, the reason that there's not so many deaths now is because most of the people who were on the fringes have caught COVID and died back during the pandemic.
I'm totally willing to accept that lockdowns are a very, they're not a precise instrument. And, of course, the countries which have done well locked down early and tested and traced.
That's a lie. That's untrue.
Okay, well, let's just a minute. Let's hear from you then, Alan, if you're going to dispute that, because certainly the statistics seem to bear up. There's been far less cases in places like New Zealand.
But New Zealand didn't lock down early. This is just an untrue statement. Essentially, in the UK and in New Zealand, they both announced they were going into lockdown on the 23rd of March, the same day. But Boris Johnson announced on the 23rd that we would be introducing a lockdown on the 24th, so he introduced it in the evening. In New Zealand, they announced lockdown on the 23rd to be introduced 2 days later, so New Zealand locked down later than the UK.
But of course, we're closer to Italy, which seems to be and of course, it's now come out in the last week that it started in Italy and not in China at all. So we're actually closer to the basis.
Just a minute. Saying where this started, Martin, is a whole new thing. Surely it was going in Wuhan back in January.
Yes, but there's issues around
which
where
it's closer
it
to New Zealand than London is.
I'll just say this. In Southeast Asia, where they pursued lockdown and test and trace, you've got to test and trace people as well. It's not just a question of lockdowns. You've got to find out who's got it. And in well-organized countries like Communist Vietnam or the Republic of China, they didn't have a lockdown. No, they did test and trace. So, I totally take your point that locking down after the virus has spread is pretty much like locking the stable door after the horse has bolted. So that's common ground.
Yes.
But of course, if you do the things right at the beginning, and of course, if you've trained for years for a biological warfare attack, as communist countries have, they did things, and it's not just the communist countries like Cuba, Vietnam, and China, of course. It's also other Southeast Asian countries like South Korea and Taiwan, who've got a militarised society.
Alan, so if the more draconian you are, the more militarised, the better you are at dealing with COVID, according to Martin.
That's just not true. The country that has the worst per capita deaths is Belgium, followed by Peru, that's got military martial law to keep people off the streets. You cannot substitute an ineffective policy for an effective policy. Track and trace can limit the spread, and they did it quite well in Iceland. Japan didn't have a lockdown and didn't do track and trace either and was effective. So what it seems like is that government policy has very little effect on the number of per capita deaths. It's other factors. It's what is the age distribution of your population? What is the prevalence of heart disease? What is your previous exposure of the population to similar coronavirus viruses in the previous year? What is the level of dead wood? How does your old people live? Do they live in older people's homes in large, like Sweden, or do they live with their parents parents and older people in the same households where it can spread? Intergenerational.
One of the other causal factors is, and I think this has been largely overlooked actually in the statistics, is the use of chloroquine and these other antiviral drugs, which were proved so effective against SARS in the past. And I think the countries that use those, but it seems to me this is a rather like this whole idea of the virus being a bioweapon, that these have become, the whole idea of chloroquine and the whole idea of this being a bioweapon has become taboo in the West. You're just simply not allowed to address these points because they would have had a massive effect on how this thing has spread and how effectively it's been being dealt with in terms of treatment. So it does all point towards there being a psychological operation aspect to this, Martin.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. And I think there's a psychological, you know, my view on this is that it's basically a biological weapon. And we could discuss what, you know, but don't forget the idea of it being a biological weapon has been pushed by Steve Bannon, pushed at one stage by Trump, pushed at one stage by the Murdoch press in Australia. And of course, they were saying it's leaked from the Wuhan laboratory, therefore the Chinese are to blame, it's the Chinese virus, etc. Now, evidence is now emerging that in actual fact, China may not be the source of the virus. That's because they're now finding people. There's a 14-year-old boy who died in Italy of coronavirus in November last year, before anything happened in China. Now, it may well be that they've seeded the bioweapon in China. That would be my view. But anyway, those are wider questions. I think when Alan was saying earlier that there were other factors that other than lockdowns which determine the...
Much more important factors.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, I'm willing to accept that there are other factors. But at the same time, earlier you said that we can't actually make comparisons between countries because there's all these different factors involved.
Well, that's why when you run a proper statistical study rather than go... just a comparison with two countries and just look at one determining factor. You control from these other factors. That's what you do with a multivariate regression.
I mean, it's a classic lies, damn lies and statistics. People have been cherry-picking statistics depending on whatever they fancy.
Sweden, for instance.
Yeah, well, do you want to talk about Sweden a bit?
Sweden.
Because now, hang on, because we've heard recently that Sweden's rates have gone up and they have actually, you know, what they've done, supposedly by getting it over with quickly and going for herd immunity, has been counterproductive, actually. And that this is certainly what I've read in the national press, is that they've actually had a bit of a spike recently and they've had to increase their measures.
Well, they haven't. They haven't really introduced... increase the most is just complete misrepresentation. If you look at Euromomo data, Sweden has no excess mortality. Its Z score, which is measures excess mortality, is below 2.
Okay, so Euromomo. I'll tell you what we'll do is we will put up a link to that on our show page so people can go and check your statistics for yourself. Because we know that statistics are being manipulated, hopefully not by us, but by the mass media. What was the website again?
Euromomo.
Euromomo.
Yes, it's here. Sorry, it's essentially it's Euromomo. That's it's how it sounds.
Okay.
And what it is a Denmark-based, EU-funded website that monitors excess mortality across Europe.
So, look, you've been going through this quite a lot, Alan. Are there any measures that actually are effective? Are the most effective measures you've found?
Why the East Anglia study is quite interesting is it broke down individual measures and worked out which measures were effective and which weren't.
Great. Well done, East Anglia University.
So what they suggested was that banning large gatherings like they did in Sweden, like they did in Iceland, was effective. Initially, they banned meetings, groups more than 50. They've reduced that. The only real change in recent social distancing policy in Sweden is that they've reduced this to 8. But you have to look at the difference between overall excess mortality, testing and deaths. So if you look at overall excess mortality, you can see whether the COVID-19 figures are reliable. Because if you've got no excess mortality, but you've got a huge spike in testing, then there's a problem with the data. It means that your testing is unreliable, particularly if your deaths are not going up.
What about the testing that's going on here? It's a lot of, I mean, it's almost like a kind of spiritual war in a weird way between the PCR tests and the, flow tests?
Seroprevalence flow test. I think it's a test graph.
Because there's two, I mean, we're now talking about, they're trying to open up care homes over Christmas with this flow test. But people have been comparing it to the PCR test that's been generally used up until now. Massively expanded use of it in August, including all new hospital entrants and things like that. And they're saying, well, it's actually not picking up all the positives that the PCR test is. Lateral flow test, isn't it? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, they both have degrees of imperfection with the data. The problem being with the PCR test is that it's very non-specific, it's expensive, it takes time for to get results back, it picks up dead viruses, it can pick up maybe similar viruses, and there is no standard number of replications. So an RT PCR test, it works by you take a sample, then you change RNA to DNA, then you replicate it. But so you essentially photocopy it, and they don't even standardize how many times they replicate it. But the trouble is, if you replicate it enough times, you always get a positive. And it, even Fauci has admitted that if you're running more than 35 replication cycles, you've not got a replicable virus.
The tests don't sound very reliable to me. And I would also say, I mean, I just picked up this week from a friend. He this is about a month ago. He got, I think it was to do with a test and trace or something. He got told you've got to go for a test. And he got through a location in North Wales. He was supposed to drive up to North Wales, spend, you know, best part of a day and a night driving up there and back for this test. And he said, well, no, I'm not going to do that. He didn't say it in quite such polite terms as I just did. Mm-hmm. And he just literally went to his local test centre, literally a 20-minute drive away, drove in there in his car. There was nobody there, no other people being tested at all. And they said to him, first thing I said to him is, has you got an appointment? He said, no. And they said, that's fine. And they gave him a test, stuck the thing up his nose, and 2 days later he got a text back saying that he was clear. It was a negative test. But I find this quite interesting that the number one, that these places are completely empty, and number two, that there doesn't seem to be any actual system. Martin, maybe you could say something about this, because you know, the idea is you're being sent somewhere you don't need to go to, and when you go to your local centre, it's empty.
Well, I think it's probably common ground that the actual management of the testing regime in this country has been execrably badly managed. It was privatised to Serco, etc. I mean, if somebody's actually got a virus, do you really want them to drive to North Wales to have a test? That's like spreading, you know, imagine what you're doing effectively is spreading the virus by doing that. And of course, countries which have done it successfully, let's think about Wuhan in China, they're the obvious place to pick. They made people lock them in their homes, tested everybody on the spot, and then they were taken not to their homes, they were taken to special isolation facilities when they tested positive.
I would question that. There is no good data from China. But I mean, I was looking today, trying to look for excess mortality, because I want to look for excess mortality to see if the COVID death figures are reliable. And I could not find reliable data for excess mortality. And there are questions about Chinese data from an academic study that looked at cremations compared to COVID-19 deaths, and they do not look reliable, so I would not trust that data.
What about the data from the Republic of China and Taiwan?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know about that data, and I don't think you do either. I'm quite familiar with UK data, a bit less with European data and American data.
I think Southeast Asia as a whole is the test of whether countries have managed this well or badly.
No, I don't think they are.
I disagree.
I think you have to look at what was the exposure to SARS-1, because people retained immunity. So you cannot compare that way without controlling for these other factors. That's why you don't compare two countries. You compare a wide, broad range of countries. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm willing to
and control for these other factors.
I think there's very definitely room for debate about all of this, about the factors that are involved. It may be that they've got previous immunity from SARS-1, as you say, but it's also, of course, simply because they're better prepared to deal with any kind of pandemic outbreak because the systems are in place.
And Taiwan didn't lock down.
Well, they didn't need to lock down because they stopped people flying in from China, and then they tested everybody that had got it.
And the other problem is this. It is pointless doing the testing now because you cannot test, track and isolate an infection that is endemic in the population. It's a complete waste of time.
Well, I've got sympathy for that view.
Like Iceland, fine.
Yeah, well, exactly. Obviously, and in any case, in places like Iceland, if you move rapidly and you've only got people coming in, flying in from the UK, basically, and other European countries, you can, it's clearly New Zealand, obviously, but where they are geographically, that gives them a bit of an advantage. I think the key question is China, obviously, and the other countries near China, like Taiwan and South Korea. Now, they may have previous, as you say, because they've had SARS-1,
cross immunity,
and that's definitely something that's to be considered. But also, of course, they've got mechanisms in place for because they've expected something like this for quite a long time. So they've got mechanisms in place to deal with it.
And you know what? They've also been planning, Martin, to take over these various privatised parts of the pandemic response and make lots and lots of money out of this. I think it's Annalise Dodds, who's the Shadow Chancellor, and she did a very good job a couple of weeks ago in putting to Rishi Sunak, who's Boris's Chancellor, a guy from Goldman Sachs, exactly the, well, she laid out actually one of the major criticisms she got of the whole response, which is the cronyism that basically these contracts and the disastrous PCR test contracts, which have led to people standing around doing nothing whilst everyone is being sent spreading the virus around the country, have all been shoveled out to their Tory mates.
Well, this spending review was a moment for the Chancellor to take the responsible choices our country needs. It was an opportunity to protect key workers, secure the economy, and recover jobs in every part of our country. During this crisis, we've seen who's taken responsibility. Community health workers working round the clock to keep us all safe. The teachers who kept working so key workers could too. The delivery drivers and shop staff who made sure we had critical food supplies. Earlier this year, the Chancellor stood on his doorstep and clapped for key workers. Today, his government institutes a pay freeze for many of them. This takes a sledgehammer to consumer confidence. Firefighters, police officers and teachers will know their spending power is going down, so they will spend less in our small businesses and on our high streets. They will spend less in our private sector. Many key workers who willingly took on so much responsibility during this crisis are now being forced to tighten their belts. Now, not in the medium term to which the Chancellor refers, now. In contrast, there's been a bonanza for those who have won contracts from this government. Companies with political connections have been 10 times more likely to win government contracts. So many businesses have worked tirelessly through this pandemic to support local communities, keep critical supplies going, and to produce drugs and vaccines at cost price in AstraZeneca's case, working with some of our country's best scientists. But in its response to this pandemic, the Conservative government has wasted and mismanaged public finances on an industrial scale. £130 million to a Conservative donor for testing kits that were unsafe. £150 million for face masks and £700 million on coveralls that couldn't be used. A £12 billion hit to our economy because the more effective shorter circuit breaker was blocked and a lengthier, more expensive lockdown put in place instead. £12 billion so far spent on a test and trace system that is still not working. And today, news of £10 billion in additional costs for PPE, at least partly down to the Conservatives' lack of pre-pandemic planning. This waste and mismanagement is part of a longer-term pattern, showing that claims today around levelling up simply don't match the evidence. Hospitals in Liverpool and Sandwell left unbuilt, over deadline by years and over budget by hundreds of millions of pounds. Not a single starter home built, despite almost £200 million being spent. Northern Powerhouse Rail, still not even approved, 6 years after being announced. The courts modernisation programme, 3 years behind schedule, letting victims down up and down this country. People in the north, more likely to have been made redundant during this crisis, holding everything else equal.
So it's a pretty incredible litany of failure there. I mean, obviously they are the opposition, and it's nice to hear them actually opposing. So a lot of the time they seem to be patting the government on the back for locking the country down. But Martin, that is an appalling list there of, it's real chumocracy, you could call it. actually, really, it's fraud. What it is, it's contract fraud. It's giving contracts, public contracts, to your friends above. And as she said right at the start there, it's 10 times more likely if you're a Tory donor to get awarded one of these contracts than not.
Yeah, well, the Good Law Project are actually taking them to court on a lot of this. And it may well be that ultimately some people are going to have to either pay the money back or are going to be prosecuted.
Well, so it's interesting, isn't it? The courts have been quite independent-minded through a lot of this. For example, the police finding it's really not going to be possible to prosecute under many of these guidelines, which aren't proper law, which have been involved in all this, the lockdown business, for example. We were just hearing a couple of weeks ago from Robert Hansen over in Hong Kong how Lord Sumption just flies around the world. He doesn't have to do any kind of quarantine or isolating, and he turns up in court with no mask on. So the courts aren't necessarily going along with this government policy at all, Alan.
It's difficult to say. It seems almost a semblance, and it's almost they seem to have dug themselves a hole, and what they're doing at this point is they're rolling out, say, a vaccine, and then reducing maybe the number of cycles of the test to avoid admitting that they've done a terrible thing and caused huge amounts of damage to people's health through the lockdowns. So they've got this excuse with the vaccines to try and pretend that they've cured us.
Well, I mean,
killed us.
Well, I mean, I'm reminded from a few years ago of that Daily Mail headline, "The Cruelty of the Carers," because although the people are supposed to be caring for you, what's happened is lots of people have simply not gone to hospital to get treatment for whatever reason, because they're afraid of catching COVID, when actually it may be that hospital is a much safer place to go than many other places, and that there's not really that much danger. But it's meant that lots of people have simply not got treatment, which they needed to live, because of this. And we heard this week, didn't we, about the massive increase, Martin, in the waiting lists. It's never been so long, and it's absolutely skyrocketed literally within the last 8 months. The hospital waiting lists, and this means people die on those waiting lists. Let's be frank about that.
Well, I mean, the at some point there will be a public inquiry into the way in this has been handled, as there was over the Iraq business, but of course that won't happen for some time. Although some people are pushing for an immediate inquiry and saying, well, we want to work out what we've done wrong already so we can stop doing things wrong. But with a majority of 80, the government basically are prepared to tough all of this out. And I think it's pretty obvious to the objective observer that they've actually been very, very remiss in everything that they've done, including their bias in favour, for example, of the private sector. So we've got so-called NHS Test and Trace, which is run by Serco, which is headed by Dido Harding. Some other countries haven't done it like that. That's what we've chosen to do.
160,000 people, the Mail and others have been reporting this week, the BBC too, whereas on waiting lists now for basic NHS treatment, much of it which is life-saving treatment, now these waiting lists. I mean, this is actually, in a way, this is a way, isn't it, of helping to privatise the National Health
Service.
Yes,
they've definitely treated it as a disaster capitalist opportunity. And of course, in other countries like the United States, as people lose their jobs as a result of the economic fallout from this, and of course, it wasn't just COVID, it was the banking collapse in September, which would have fed through anyway if they hadn't gone for massive QE. The people, as they lose their jobs, lose their healthcare protection, because it's often their jobs are is basically their health insurance. So you've got millions of people in the US who are not on waiting lists and being not allowed to have their hip replacements done. They were never going to get their hip replacements done in the first place. And countries like that, with no proper healthcare system, have obviously suffered much worse than those other countries like Iceland or wherever, where there is a proper healthcare system.
Okay, so 160,000 people. Not this isn't the number of people in a queue. This is the number of people in a queue for over a year. Do you want to guess how many times more that figure is than the same figure last year for people over a year waiting in a queue for basic treatment?
I don't know, about three or four times.
Alan, would you like to guess how many more people this year at this point in time than this time last year, waiting over a year for basic treatment?
I don't know. I just...
I want you to have a guess. I'm going to pin you down. Sorry, but I just want you to guess. How many more people this year are waiting over a year for... this time this year, waiting over a year for basic NHS treatment? This is things like hip replacements, this kind of thing.
100,000?
Times? Okay. How many times more than this time last year? Actually, it's, anyway, Martin guessed, what did you say, four times, Martin?
I said three or four.
Three times. Or four times. It's 100 times. So it's a massive, massive increase. Mm. So the NHS is basically not being able to do its job in keeping Britain healthy.
Yes, and of course the NHS has been sidelined by all of this, you know, creation from scratch of, you know, a privatised test and trace system, etc. But of course we're talking here about NHS waiting times in places like Brazil and the United States. People don't get, there's no waiting times because if you've got no money, you don't get treated in the first place. And of course the countries which haven't got a basic public health system are very badly placed to deal with anything like this.
And lockdowns are a very stupid idea because people starve when you do that. They're talking about, what, 150,000 people put in extreme poverty and start, you know, across the world. This is, you know, but in the UK, what's even more worrying is that you get people appearing for heart attacks. A hospital is down by half over this period. So this will cause short-term deaths. So there's going to be two main effects. There's going to be short-term deaths due to lack of medical treatment for heart attacks, strokes, all the rest of it. And then there's going to be long-term health effects through missed cancer screenings and treatment.
And the preventative side of the NHS falling apart.
And
right.
Increased poverty. So this is going to cost millions.
You know what's happened is a lot of this preventative money has gone into vaccines because the money and the effort has been put into vaccines, seeing that as a preventative measure.
Well, also doctors have been directed to see less people so they can carry out more pointless vaccines.
Well, you say the vaccine's pointless. That's quite a controversial thing to say. I think a lot of people would disagree with you. But anyway, the big news this week was on Tuesday when we saw the first person in Britain get the Pfizer-Moderna vaccine, who hadn't actually been involved in a trial. So let's have a listen to the report on that now.
In the last few minutes, the UK's mass vaccination programme against coronavirus has begun.
This is Margaret Keenan, who you can see there. She is 90. She's 91 next week, actually. She was the first person to receive the Pfizer-BioNTech jab at the University College Hospital in Coventry. That's one of 70 hospitals around the UK which will be giving the vaccine to over 80s and some health and care staff. And the Prime Minister has called it a huge step forward in the fight against the disease.
This is quite a moment. This, as you can see, is the first person in the UK to receive the vaccine. Margaret's been a patient at Coventry Hospital, as Dan said. She's 91 next week. She's told staff, "This jab feels like an early birthday present." The nurse delivering the jab, you can see there, is matron May Parsons. And that has just happened within the last few minutes. These pictures that we're bringing to you have just come into us here this morning. Margaret, of course, she's known as Maggie. Mm. Happy to share this moment with the rest of the world.
It's quite a special moment, actually, isn't it? So, as Sally was saying, it's her birthday next year. She was born in Enniskillen. She's lived in Coventry for 60 years. She worked in a jewellery shop, local jewellery shop, until she was in her mid-80s. But this is all part of the largest ever vaccination programme across the NHS.
Yeah, they actually don't know that because they don't know how many people are going to have this vaccine. They certainly want it to be the largest. But anyway, I was waiting during that report for some sort of journalistic criticism of it, at least saying that is this going to be... is there going to be potentially pitfalls here? But they weren't saying that at all. It was all just being pushed as almost as if they were doing an advert, Alan, for Pfizer.
This is problematic because even Mark Yeadon, the former vice president of Pfizer.
Well, I thought he was his chief scientific advisor.
He was both. Has raised questions about these vaccines. Now these are a completely new technology, messenger RNA vaccine. So a normal vaccine essentially uses a denatured virus to trigger your immune system. But
when you mean, say, denatured, what do you mean?
It's a less potent, like, say, for instance, when vaccines were first kind of discovered in a way, people would be treated with cowpox because it was less deadly than smallpox.
Even though it was just a very similar virus.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I've heard that talked about as an attenuated virus.
Yes.
So the idea is it's not so deadly, but your body basically treats it as the same.
Yes, that's. But this works in a different way. What happens is that, because this is from Dr. Bakhti, is that the immune system isn't just antibodies. Antibodies, memory T cells, killer T cells, mucosal immunity. The problem is, obviously, when an antibody, it binds to the virus site, which stops it kind of infecting.
Okay, this is on a cell. So where the viruses normally go into a cell, the antibody will be sitting there in the way, so the virus can't get into the cell.
But killer T cells work in a different way. The problem is, rather than attack the virus, they look at virus shedding by human cells, and if they perceive them to be shedding viral loads, then they kill the human cell. The problem is, a messenger RNA makes your body create viral fragments to trigger the immune system.
Okay, so the idea really here is that rather than bringing a virus in for your immune system to attack, you trick your own body cells into producing something that looks like the virus, so that triggers an immune response, and you get your own immune system attacking your own cells.
Yes. So the problem, Dr. Bakhti didn't say on trigonometry or whatever program interview that this would necessarily cause autoimmunity, but he said because there hasn't been long-term testing and this is a new technology, he was worried this could be the case.
Yeah, they haven't really said much about the new technology, have they, on the BBC, CNN. They have had some graphics. I noticed one up on National Geographic, which was actually, I managed to find one, and it was totally incorrect. So it was saying that the new messenger RNA vaccines produce the viral antigen on the surface of the virus. They don't. They produce the viral antigen on the surface of your cells. So this is just basically wrong. The most important thing, I think, about this all, though, and I'll bring you in, Martin, now, is that we've got to understand that this is the first ever type of medical treatment that's been allowed on humans, which is editing our genetic material, in going into our cells, swapping around something that's going on inside your DNA so that your cell starts to produce something from that DNA that it wouldn't normally do.
Yeah, and they've obviously been investigating this for some years, but this disaster has allowed them to bring, you know, say this is an emergency, so this is an opportunity for us to use this new technology. And of course, I can't see. I mean, most vaccines are developed over years, and you've got to carry out tests on animals and so on. So you've got to test what the side effects are. Honestly, they haven't done any of that. And of course, it's all being treated as a rah, 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 this is the solution. And of course, the other thing about the Pfizer vaccine is massively expensive. I think something like $35 a shot, compared to the AstraZeneca one, which is $2 or $3. And of course, ultimately, that means when they're talking about we've vaccinated one person and they're going about mass vaccination.
So who is, I wonder,
what are they on about? There's one person.
I wonder who has determined that price. Is it the shareholders of Pfizer?
Well, what it is, Pfizer are well positioned to say,
ours is the first. We can charge what we want.
Took an option out on the shares in Pfizer. And when they made the announcement, the shares shot up, and he made a cool, you know, he'd already arranged.
Well, if he
to
sold
make
his
pounds.
Shares, it doesn't say very much for his confidence in this vaccine.
Well, also, the other thing that happened with AstraZeneca is as their vaccine came forward, their shares went down because they're doing it at cost. And this is one of the problems with all of these things. If you're doing it for profit, the Russian vaccine, the Cuban vaccine, have been developed by the public sector. And of course, then there's still problems with it because it's all done.
So
in
the incredible thing is, we've sacrificed most of the preventative work of the National Health Service for a vaccine, Alan, that may not actually work.
Or it could work too well and overstimulate the immune system.
Yeah, you could actually spread the COVID.
Yeah, that's it did with polio.
Yeah.
We've seen vaccine-originated polio is a far greater problem now than natural polio, which was basically gotten rid of by previous versions of the polio vaccine before Bill Gates got involved. Anyway, talking about this whole idea of animal trials, not doing any trials on animals, well, there may be reasons for that. And I came across a fascinating clip from Dr. Carrie Madej this week where she talks about that exact subject. She's part of the World Doctors Alliance, but she's specifically looked into a bit of an expert on the trials of these mRNA vaccines in the past.
This kind of vaccine, this modified messenger RNA, modified DNA vaccine, they have tried them in the past 20 years on animal studies. And they've been terrible results because in these studies, when the animals got the vaccine, at first they had robust immune systems, great antibodies, T cell response, great, good, looking good. Then they challenged them with that virus or that bacteria. And every time, the animals got sicker or died much more than the placebo group. Because the body had something called a cytokine storm. It actually saw this as and had a more aggressive reaction, and it attacked its own lungs, attacked its own liver, had almost like a sepsis response in the body. So we can expect that, and I think that's why they skipped the animal trials with this vaccine. They don't want anyone to know that. So in a human, you're not supposed to challenge them with the virus. That's unethical. You can only do that with an animal. So guess when all these people who get the vaccine, when will they be challenged? The next flu season, maybe the next cold they get. And then they'll blame it on the COVID-20.
You know, we'll have to prepare for the next one. That, you know, I'd say is will get attention this time. Mm-hmm.
And then they'll blame it on the COVID-20 killing them when it wasn't. It was the vaccine that they intentionally gave them, knowing the results, knowing how many people they would hurt and kill, how many children they would hurt and kill. This is intentional, and people need to wake up to this because that's pure science right there. And you can ignore all the other technologies I said, but that is something you cannot refute.
Well, I'm sure someone somewhere at Pfizer will refute it. But it's an interesting theory, isn't it, that this Pfizer vaccine might actually make people more susceptible. And that is echoed in the US Army study that came out in March, April time, which I was pretty shocked to see. This is about an American troop of American soldiers, where a whole group of them, something like a third, went down quite badly with COVID. And the commanding officers were very surprised because basically people that age weren't being affected much by COVID-19. And it turned out, Alan, that these people had all had the flu jab the previous winter. And that made them much more susceptible to COVID. So, I mean, obviously, this is the sort of thing that you know, if they're not trying this Pfizer mRNA vaccine on the elderly, they're not trying it on animals. They're trying it. Actually, what they're doing is they're injecting it into the elderly, which is incredible. It may be that we have another wave of elderly people that die because of this. I find it absolutely incredible. And I will share these the two articles that I got, one from the CDC in the United States and one from the British Medical Association article on what's been going on here at the MNRA, which is the the medicines regulator here that approved this Pfizer vaccine, all of them saying that we should not be using this on the elderly, particularly because it hasn't been tested on them, and neither has it been tested on animals.
It's also then after the recent poor reactions with the two health workers, the recent advice is anybody with any allergic reaction shouldn't be taking it either, which it seems kind of strange because COVID-19 isn't dangerous for most people. It's only dangerous for the people with pre-existing conditions that are older. So a vaccine would only be useful for those groups if it was safe, but it hasn't been proved safe.
Amazing. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, getting very, very enthusiastic about this on Tuesday, the first injection of the Pfizer vaccine into a lovely little old lady.
I'm so proud of the team who've made this happen. I'm so proud of them. They've worked so hard, and not just hard, but really smart. You know, firstly, the team who spotted that this was a really promising vaccine, and we bought it early. We were the first country to put in an order. And then the regulator, you know, normally regulators get flack, but the MHRA have done a fantastic job because they've done all of the safety checks that they always do, but they've done them all at the same time instead of one after the other, which has meant that we've been the first country in the world, you know, and after this year, which has been so terrible for so many people and the sacrifices people have made and the losses that we've all suffered to have this moment showing the way out is just absolutely fantastic.
You want to play a little clip from William Shakespeare, who's just said his first words. Let's take a listen to this.
Fill us with patient number two. Groundbreaking, I think. It could make a difference to our lives from now on, couldn't it? Started changing our lives and our lifestyle. It's a precaution, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it will be a precaution.
And I guess it's been tough for you being at home and being locked down.
We've been virtually locked down. My wife has managed to get out occasionally to a local shop.
I mean, just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been, you know, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
It does.
So that's Piers Morgan agreeing that it makes him proud to be British, even though we could be embarking on yet another disastrous error by Matt Hancock, who's already been involved in the decisions, very closely involved, although Portland Communications were breathing down his neck, and George Pascoe Watson and the private healthcare industry managing to wiggle their way into the Department of Health there somehow, even though they didn't declare they were even in there right from the very beginning of this pandemic. And back in March, these decisions being made by Hancock, including sending people out of hospitals, clearing out hospitals unnecessarily, putting those people without being tested into care homes, spreading COVID-19 to the very most vulnerable people, Martin, in the country.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously a politician, let's face it, and he's trying to find a silver lining in his own incompetent managing of what he's responsible for.
We haven't really heard much emotion from him, but there was definitely a lot of emotion in that, wasn't there?
Well, he was either laughing or crying. I couldn't work out which one it was. But I mean, the point is, I mean, this idea that he was crying with joy at the whole
idea of this Pfizer vaccine now being rolled out.
Yeah, but I mean, it's basically hooray, we're saved. I mean, you know, I'm just not convinced, and I don't think anybody should be convinced by that.
Alan?
Well, I mean, it seems at this point not particularly useful because we seem to have kind of reached kind of a level of herd immunity which seems to come in at a much lower level than the ridiculous assertions of Neil Ferguson at 80%.
Well, how do you explain the quite high numbers of cases here in Bristol, for example, though?
Well, they're not matched by the deaths. There has been an increase in deaths, supposed COVID-19 deaths, even though they've been sort of massively increasing the definition to include everything in a COVID-19 death, i.e. anybody who dies within 28 days of having a positive COVID-19 test that is fairly inaccurate is a COVID-19 death. So you haven't had that massive increase in overall mortality, you can see that these figures are not reliable.
So anyway, I was really interested to see what the BBC and others, but particularly the BBC, since they're our public service broadcaster supposedly, would say about the vaccine, because I wanted to know, are the BBC going to tell us what is this vaccine? What's in it?
Just a little bit more about the vaccine that she has had. We know that 800,000 doses of the vaccine have been delivered. That's enough for 400,000 people, of course, because this is the one where you have one jab and then another one in 21 days' time. And we don't know yet when more doses of the vaccine will arrive from Pfizer's manufacturing plant. But that moment that we've just brought to you there feels like something, doesn't it?
It does feel quite significant, doesn't it? And hospital hubs now around the country have got possession of the vaccine, and they'll start vaccinating over 80s, care home staff and health workers. This is the first wave of the programme. If you just switched on BBC Breakfast this morning, the two women that you're watching there are Matron May Parsons on the right, who's giving the first coronavirus vaccine to Maggie Keenan, who's smiling behind the mask, wearing a Christmas T-shirt. She's 90 years old. It's her 91st birthday next week. And she's in University College, at University Hospital in Coventry this morning, receiving the very first coronavirus vaccine in the UK.
And, you know, these are pictures that will go all over the world, I imagine. Certainly, you know, we here in the UK, we are the first Western nation to administer this vaccine. Maggie is very happy for her picture to be taken and has agreed to do this. She actually had the vaccination just around 6:30 this morning. And, you know, she's been checked out by everybody. She is well, feeling fine. You can see her having a chat to the matron there. We saw her being prepared for the injection. Very calm, very happy. And as Dan said, she's saying this is like an early birthday present. She is 91 next week, and until only just a couple of years ago was working in a local jewellery store. She's been living in the Midlands for the last 30 years, originally from Enniskillen, but very much settled in the Midlands now and expecting a quiet family Christmas.
Yeah.
Now, I think we'll leave it there because we're not going anywhere with the BBC. Wanting to know a bit about what it is that's being put inside this lady, we're not getting anywhere. One of the things that's come out this week, Martin, though, is, or just today, actually, is that clinical trials of COVID-19 vaccines being developed by the University of Queensland in partnership with biotech company CSL have been abandoned after the trial participants returned positive HIV results. Now, they say they're false positives, but we reported, didn't we, about 2 months ago that King's College in London, I believe it was King's College, had said that, had put out a proper official report saying that many of the people who were suffering from COVID also showed similar signs to HIV/AIDS. Now, whether that's true or not, I've no idea, but it does tally with what the we were reporting back in February, that this was a bioweapon which had the SARS and AIDS protein implanted into it.
Yeah, but I don't think it's the actual. It's not HIV as such, is it? It's just some sequences from HIV.
These are people who've been on the vaccine trials, and they've now been. I mean, for whatever reason, they're giving them AIDS tests as well. I mean, they're obviously giving them all sorts of blood tests. But when they've given them the AIDS test, which I wouldn't imagine they would normally do in most of these trials that we've seen over the last 8 months, they've found them testing positive for AIDS.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen that, but I mean, obviously, giving people AIDS when you give them a vaccination is not really a very good idea, is it?
They have actually, didn't they? On Wednesday morning, they were very adamant, saying people with Alan with autoimmune responses should think twice about taking the virus if they've got a history of that in their family, things like Parkinson's or whatever.
Mm. And they've also they've come up with also serious side effects like. Paralysis, a temporary paralysis in the face as well, which doesn't scream safe at me particularly.
So what about you? What are your precautions that you're taking not to catch COVID? Do you think it's really a threat still at the moment?
I don't think it is. I think if you look at say ONS website, registered deaths in England and Wales, you can see the profile of daily deaths, and There's no commensurate. There's a slight increase now, but you can't call it the same as the peak that of daily deaths that peaked in 8th of April. So I think it's come and gone. I mean, one paper I said I'm seeing seems to suggest that herd immunity comes in at about 15-20% because of cross immunity, because antibodies aren't the only form of defense. Sometimes it doesn't even get to antibodies. It's like T-cell response or cross-immunity.
Well, we've had a pretty good discussion about this vaccine and whether it's going to help people or not, which is a discussion which has not been taking place on the mainstream press. A tremendous amount of censorship of doctors, because it's not as if there's any shortage. The World Doctors Alliance, at the end of last week, put out a video which was immediately censored by YouTube, never used by our mainstream press, with about 30 doctors on there, each of them giving a short talk explaining what they thought of the vaccine, and not a single one of them was complimentary, you won't be surprised to hear. But what I find so shocking is that we've got a media which is not taking any notice of what doctors are saying if they're critical. So it's almost like it's some sort of gigantic Pfizer, Boris Johnson advertising, Matt Hancock advertising firm, rather than a journalistic operation. And I think we all need to be very aware of that, particularly, Martin, I mean, you may not agree with what I'm saying about COVID, but particularly after the September the 11th attacks and other things like terrorist events, we've seen, haven't we, that critical voices are completely shut out of the mainstream news in order to create a false impression with the public.
Well, I mean, there's also, as we know, the media is, you know, controlled by government agencies and by the corporate sector, and that is the reality of it. I mean, what we heard from the BBC earlier was essentially a kind of advert for the vaccine. There was no critical perspective on it at all, and you know, I mean, and of course, what we've now got Brigade 77, the British Army's psychological warfare unit, which is supposedly there to counter Russian propaganda or whatever, and they are working behind the scenes discredit, as they call it, those who are questioning vaccines and so on. But of course, there's perfectly legitimate questions to be asked about mass vaccination, and you know, it's when they say anti-vaxxers, I mean, I'm not anti-vaccination as such. The question is this one effective, is it cost effective, and is it potentially dangerous? And I think those are perfectly legitimate questions.
You have to balance cost benefit. Like, for a very dangerous disease like smallpox, then a vaccine, if proved safe, although has a risk, probably has a lower risk than a very dangerous disease. But with COVID-19, I don't see how you have to have max vaccination, because for most people, they can acquire natural immunity safely. They can expose, for a small percentage of people, COVID-19 is dangerous, say, average age 82, three or more kind of serious comorbidities. But the trouble is a vaccine even safe for these people? So it would be good to have a vaccine, if proved safe, for these people, but they haven't proved their case this is safe. So it would be an addition to natural herd immunity for people that couldn't be exposed, if proved safe.
So anyway, we're going to do a bit of anti-censorship now, and it was interesting to see the World Doctors Alliance video actually started off by a guy called Dr. Kaufman, who's one of those that says he doesn't believe a virus exists, which doesn't seem to be very smart of the World Doctors Alliance to start with him. So that was the first doctor I saw, and I thought, well, I'm not going to bother to watch this. But actually, if you watch through the rest of it, you'll find there's actually some very, very well-informed and interesting dogs. So as a sort of message, I think we should be contacting the World Doctors Alliance and saying, you are discrediting yourself by putting ICIST doctors certainly at the front of your video, but anywhere near your videos. I mean, this is a sort of technique, Martin, isn't it, that's used in order to discredit an entire organisation by having spurious claims about there having never been a virus, and that really does discredit, you know, much of what the other doctors are saying.
Well, there's obviously everybody has got an opinion about this. Various doctors have got different opinions, and you know, it's very hard to sift out what is genuinely, doctors, for example, often have political views. I mean, the Great Barrington Declaration was set up by a right-wing US economics think tank.
That isn't true.
Well, not directly, but pretty much.
No, that isn't true. If you look at the main signatories, no, they're not. They're
well,
not,
in any case, the Great Barrington Declaration, anybody can sign it. I could sign it, you could sign it, and all they're doing is they're politicking around what's going on. Of course, others are politicking in the opposite direction.
No, I don't agree. If you look at the main signatories who actually designed the Barrington Declaration, like Professor Sunitra Gupta, they're top of their field.
I mean, it's a bit mean to criticise.
And she's off the left.
People have, you know, made fraudulent claims and said, I'm going to sign this because I'm a doctor, but actually they're committing a fraud by saying they are a doctor.
I haven't got a computer in front of me, but where the Great Barrington, which is where they made the statement, is the headquarters of something called the Institute of Economic Affairs or something similar. And they were the ones who got it all together because they're against lockdowns. There are legitimate reasons for being against lockdowns.
No, they didn't get it together. That they supply a house does not undermine the message.
I think the truth is probably halfway between the two. What you've got is some doctors who want to do some big splash PR thing. And what they do is they're fishing around for someone who will back it and give them some money and some space to do it.
Yeah, and I think that what you've got here is, I mean, there are legitimate arguments about lockdown, which we've been having, but some people are against lockdowns because they're against the whole idea of the economy being stopped to try and deal with a health.
So really, I dispute that.
I'm not saying you. I'm just saying some people say that.
When I've listened to the people behind the Barrington Declaration that actually designed it, no, that's not.
Okay. Well, anyway, we're going to have a listen now to some of the uncensored on this show doctors who've been talking about the vaccine this week, and one of them is the one we heard earlier on. That's Carrie Madej, who seems particularly impassioned and articulate, and she, I think, is at the end of this. So it's about 5 minutes of doctors saying what they think about the vaccine who've been censored.
Dr. Elizabeth Evans, retired doctor and co-founder of the UK Medical Freedom Alliance. The COVID-19 vaccines are not proven to be safe or effective. We believe that it is reckless and unnecessary to roll out these essentially experimental vaccines that are using a completely new mRNA technology to millions of people when there is only limited short-term safety data, no evidence that they will prevent transmission of the virus, and no long-term safety data to rule out late-onset negative effects like autoimmune diseases, infertility, and cancers.
This is Dr. Mohammed Adel from United Kingdom. I am fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons of UK and consultant surgeon. I have been working for the National Health Services for the last 30 years with unblemished record. I am chairman of the Global Nectarian Organization, All Pakistan Medical Association UK, and recently we have developed World Doctors Alliance in collaboration with thousands of health professionals across the world. Recently, we had a very successful webinar which has been viewed by millions of people across the world. I am standing for the cause of the humanity, especially in the current situation of the devastating effect due to coronavirus and its restriction imposed on the public. Many thanks.
Doctors aren't allowed to question COVID-19 in public. Material containing the truth about the alleged disease and the vaccine is banned. In the last year, I've been demonized and lied about, and a 50-year career and reputation trashed by those promoting a pandemic that never was and a vaccine that was never needed. The whole COVID-19 scam is, as I said in March 2020, the greatest hoax in history. The principle of informed consent is essential in medicine, but patients now having vaccines can't give informed consent because they aren't being informed. Thank heavens for sites such as Brand YouTube, which carry uncensored videos by doctors who've been censored or banned elsewhere.
My name is Zach Cox. I'm a holistic dentist and a homeopath. I'm a founder member of the World Doctors Alliance. I believe that the pandemic is fundamentally over and was so in the summer. I also firmly believe that there is no long-term safety data on any of the COVID vaccines. This means that they are essentially experimenting on us, which is against the Nuremberg Code. I will not be taking the vaccine.
Hello, I'm Dr. Anna Forbes. I'm a UK medical doctor here representing the UK Medical Freedom Alliance. This is a growing body of doctors, scientists, academics and lawyers. We believe that there has been an overestimation of the public health risk from SARS-CoV-2 due to misrepresentation of data and inappropriate use of the PCR test.
My name is Anne Lafayne. I'm a medical doctor from Belgium, specialized in chronic infectious diseases such as Lyme, Epstein-Barr, molds, etc. The COVID-19 vaccine is not proven safe nor effective. And I think it's unacceptable that all liabilities have been waived for the companies that are producing it. If pharma doesn't take responsibility for the products they make, how can they expect doctors to inject them to their patients without doubt of doing harm? More and more, we see that this is really not a medical pandemic. The measures for corona caused far more collateral damage than the virus causes itself. Worldwide, we see that the numbers of cases are falsely presented in order to drive the population to obedient behavior and to vaccination. So please be critical. Do your own research and don't let the media manipulate you. I think it's time to react. Time to stand up for your freedom, for the future of your children. Don't give in to anxiety, to polarization, to governmental control, and to restriction of your freedom, all under the false pretext of a virus, because that's what's happening.
I'm Dr. Kevin Corbett, a retired registered nurse and health scientist in the United Kingdom. The COVID vaccines are not proven safe or effective. COVID is not a real medical epidemic. The vaccines use synthetic products that will alter your genes, allow monitoring of your vaccination status, and produce dangerous chemical reactions. Scientists are therefore demanding that all COVID vaccinations be immediately stopped. The real epidemic is fear and hysteria. It started in China and quickly spread via the World Health Organization. The hysteria was accelerated by corporations who gained financially through selling fast-tracked, flawed medical tests, toxic antiviral drugs, and now unproven and potentially dangerous vaccines. Standard precautions which normally protect the public have been disregarded due to ignorance, hysteria, and profits. For example, the vaccines have not undergone proper phase 3 tests. The COVID test, the PCR, is fatally flawed. It was never examined in the standard way by the United Kingdom National Health Service, and it should never have been used on sick people or those with no symptoms. You can read about the flaws in the PCR test at www.cormandrostenreview.com.
My name is Dr. Carrie Made. I am an internal medicine physician from the United States of America. I've owned my own clinic, and I've been medical director of 2 different clinics, as well as being an attending physician for medical students over the last 19 years. I'm here to tell you that there is no worldwide pandemic for COVID-19. We're using testing mechanisms called PCR that have never been indicated or created to diagnose any infection. This is not the way we should be diagnosing. In addition, hospitals and doctors are getting financial incentives to diagnose COVID-19. On top of that, we have multiple lab errors happening around the world over and over, indicating more false positives. On top of that, I am here to tell you that I will not take the COVID-19 vaccine, and I will not recommend the COVID-19 vaccine for any of my patients. This vaccine is experimental on the human race because they are proposing to use modified messenger RNA or modified DNA, synthetic, to the human body. This is the first time ever this will ever be launched on the human race. We don't know what could happen to us. In addition, they're proposing to use nanolipid technology or nanotechnology on the human race as well. There are so many different awful things that can happen to us, and we need to investigate this before we go forward. This is my alarm call to the world.
My name is Dr. Bear Lando, and I've treated many vaccine-damaged children.
due to the lack of proper testing and the spurious conditions surrounding the alleged pandemic, I would highly caution anyone considering taking the COVID-19 vaccine.
Okay, so there she was near the end of that, Carrie Madde. That's at least she pronounces her name right. I got it all wrong, but that's Carrie Madde. The spelling is MADEJ. And she seems to be one of those people who's just particularly good at explaining how this stuff works, because obviously there's loads of jargon in the medical sector, but she spent it seems to me a career talking to patients and being very good at getting across what's going on inside their bodies. At the end of the day, though, Alan, I mean, the vaccine is there. I'm looking at this thinking, well, it's not a very good idea to be mixing politicians with decisions about our health. Maybe it's not a good idea to be mixing politicians with any decisions, but someone's got to do it. But the idea that politicians are making these decisions about healthcare, is Matt Hancock, do you think, going to make any reasonable choices?
No, he doesn't seem to understand anything really. I mean, it's
the politicisation of health.
Yes, but they don't seem to be even kind of politicians of stature. They seem to sort of agree to whatever was told to them by Neil Ferguson in the last hour. They don't seem to understand. And these things can develop over decades. Like thalidomide, it took decades for the problems with thalidomide to come out. And the American Food and Drug Administration at the time, under the person at the time, refused to allow thalidomide license in the US, unlike a lot of European countries.
And that was actually developed by the Nazis, thalidomide, originally. It was something that was taken off the shelf by one of the, I think it was Bayer, one of the big Nazi companies, or it would have been IG Farben during the Second World War. Yeah. And then this was rolled out. We thought, oh, look at this Nazi thing. Maybe we could just roll it out across the country. And, of course, it led to horrendous birth defects, which were, by the way, for the first few years, completely denied by the manufacturers as ever. Yes. Martin, this is a bigger thing going on here, isn't there? This is really the healthcare industry trying to use the pandemic, disaster capitalism, in order to make a lot of money. But they're also, in the process, completely discrediting the whole democratic system. Our democratically elected politicians are sitting on the back benches, but in government there's Matt Hancock who's making it what it seems like a series of disastrous decisions. The real beneficiaries of all of this are the private sector, as they point the finger at the parliamentary system and saying, look what a disaster it is. They are sitting waiting in the wings with bags full of money.
Well, I think it's common ground that big pharma in the West is corrupt. I mean, it just is. I mean, Ivan Illich wrote a book called Medical Nemesis, which came out in 1964, about the medical system in the United States. And it's basically, it's not a wellness system, it's an illness system. And you know, people who work for the pharmaceutical companies have made it clear for years that they're not in the business of curing disease. They're in the business of creating dependency on their products, because it's basically profit run. Now, obviously, in communist countries like Cuba, they've developed their own vaccines. It's only a small country, but they've got the capability to develop their own vaccines, and they've got two competing vaccines. And, of course, the Chinese have been developing their vaccine, and they're going around the world saying, we will provide this to you at cost. What's actually happened is the major Western countries, which have got the fiscal resources, have bought up all of the private vaccines that are produced by countries by companies like Pfizer, and this basically is, you know, it is disaster capitalism. And I think, you know, there's all sorts of debates we could have about what COVID is, how it came about, whether it's dangerous or not. But the pharmaceutical companies in the West are the problem; they're not the solution. And of course, the developing world has been saying for years, we've got to get rid of this idea of patenting medicines. And then, you know, basically healthcare should be socialized. And that doesn't mean you're going to get it right. You can still make mistakes. But if you've got the private sector basically trying to profiteer out of illness, it's bound to be wrong, isn't it?
So we've got demonstrations taking place against the lockdowns, against the vaccine, both in Bristol tomorrow at 12 noon on College Green, and in Oxford tomorrow, I believe, is also one, and possibly elsewhere. But I'm not sure what time that one is, but I think it's 12, maybe 1 p.m. at Bond Square in Oxford. The problem here is that there's all sorts of overreaction to this. Martin, you're always going about how wonderful the Chinese is. I noticed a story on the BBC website. China is asking its cabin crew to wear nappies to reduce the risk of virus. China's aviation regulator has recommended its cabin crew wear disposable nappies and avoid using the toilet to cut the risk of COVID-19 infection. The advice on nappies is in a section on personal protective equipment in new guidelines for airlines. The regulator said the recommendations apply to charter flights to high-risk COVID-19 destinations as well as others. Globally, airlines and airports have been making big changes to how they operate to get passengers flying again. But, I mean, this is surely not going to really make any difference, is it?
But, I mean, things like wearing nappies, it sounds silly, but it's not going to do any harm, is it? Unlike a vaccine, which may, in fact, give you the things that you're trying to vaccinate against. If you adopt simple measures like face masks and nappies, if you like, even if they don't work, they're not going to do major damage. Vaccines could cause major damage.
Well, what we heard back, I can remember this in the 90s, working at the BBC in London, chatting with some reporters there, and one of them got a story out which caused an enormous furore, because there were London businesses, restaurants and clubs were starting to introduce these disposable toilet covers. This is a bit of plastic that you put over the toilet before you use it, particularly for women. And they were supposed to protect you against AIDS. Now, at the time, this was seen to be the, you know, creme de la creme in AIDS protection. Actually, some senior people at one of the major London hospitals pointed out that it actually gives you no protection whatsoever against AIDS. So there is a liability, you know, sometimes, Alan, to overreact to this.
Well, it is, because, I mean, there is, these are not costless. So you think, oh, we'll just wear a mask for a bit. But if you're going to subject the entire nation and large sections of the world to OCD, these are going to cause deaths by themselves. Inducing a state of fear and hysteria in the population, never mind negative health effects from wearing a mask over your face, which collects bacteria and fungi and gives you an increased risk of lung infection, as studies have shown. It's not healthy to keep people in a state of hysteria. According to the parasite stress theory, people become more malleable and adhere to a totalitarian government under a state of an epidemic or a perceived epidemic. So these are dangerous things in themselves.
Teenage kits. This is in the Sun this week. Martin, the poorer people in Kent are going to be tested. That is to say, school kids. That's at least what they're saying. Teenage kits, COVID testing for all secondary school kids in the worst hit parts of London, Kent and Essex, even if they don't have symptoms, and that includes in the poorest areas. So this idea of testing, maybe I'll ask you about this first before we hear from Martin, Alan, because I know it's a bit of a bugbear of yours, the idea of testing tens of thousands of teenage school children who don't have any symptoms of COVID.
Well, and also you would damage their education. So you say the schools
are open. Well, it might only take 5 minutes.
Yes, but the problem is if somebody tests positive, whether or not that test is valid and whether they had some sort of remnants of an inert virus strain, then you have to close down the entire school.
Well, even if they caught full-blown COVID 8 months ago in March, they will have maybe a few remnants of it left that their body just basically kicked straight into the long grass in 5 seconds. There might be a few little bits and pieces of it left, but they will then be positive, and there'll be a whole kind of avalanche cascade of other people that have to then lock down. So you can see, Martin, can't you, why people just don't want to go and get tested when it's picking up so many, you know, you can call them false positives, but that they may be positive COVID tests, but that the body has dealt with that COVID many, many months ago, and it possibly even didn't have any symptoms whatsoever in the person.
Well, I don't really want to enter into an argument about whether the tests are effective or not. I'm willing to accept that perhaps they're not. I think it's more a question of, the underlying all of this is whether what this actually is, what the psychological warfare aspects of this are. It's certainly the case that different countries with very different political systems have all treated this as if it was serious. Now, don't forget, there could easily be another pandemic, which is not to do with COVID.
I don't think anyone's saying it's not serious, Marty, or it hasn't been serious in the past. What I'm concerned about is that, you know, for example, we've got the Tier 3, Tier 1, Tier 2 review happening next week. London could then go into Tier 3. Loads of businesses shut down. I mean, this is an absolutely massive impact. Although we keep hearing from doctors again and again that, number one, it never reached the criteria for a pandemic, and number two, it was over long ago, and that basically the death figures are being massaged upwards.
Well, I mean, you can say that. I think the fact that you've got all of these different countries with very different political systems treating it as if it was a pandemic suggests to me that, and in any case, it may be a false alarm, but of course the next one won't be a false alarm, and you've got to develop the techniques for dealing with the potential for pandemics.
But remember the boy who cried wolf. If they ramp this up the UK has got low excess mortality and hasn't had any serious excess mortality since June, then if they do have a serious pandemic, people are not going to believe them. This is very dangerous.
Well, as I say, it's not just this country. Different countries with very different political systems have all adopted the same strategy.
That doesn't prove anything. I mean, you get hysteria. You have the hysteria of crowds, and people will follow these hysterias for their own purposes, because people who want to gain and maintain power, it's useful for them to exploit parasite stress theory as social control.
In other words, it could be a biological weapon designed to do exactly that to the Chinese economy last November.
And it's one thing that was pointed out to me by a journalist in the north of England, was that something that's dawned on her the last few days, that all the people who say one COVID death is too many is fine, and yet if you say one vaccine death is too many, you're an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, I mean, it seems kind of absurd. It should be in proportion. There's been no released audit on how many people they're supposed to have been saved from COVID-19 that's realistic, and no commensurate audit of how many people they've killed in the process with the lockdown measures.
Well, this is the basic stuff, isn't it? Anyway, I don't know if you'd like to sum up, Martin, where you think this is going. Do you think we're going to go for more lockdowns next week? Well, I say lockdowns, I'm talking about Tier 3. Because, I mean, people are wanting the entertainment industry to at least have a chance of getting going, even if it is socially distanced, and other things. You know, basically, things like, you know, gyms reopening in certain places. I think now in Tier 3, gyms have managed to lobby to get themselves reopened, but to stop these measures in time for Christmas.
Well, I think some countries have basically defeated the virus. They don't need vaccines. They don't need lockdowns.
Yeah, but as soon as somebody with the virus comes into that country, then they're going to have to start.
Yeah, but they're not going to allow
them. It could be over Christmas.
What's going to happen is they're going to. You asked me to predict what's going to happen going forward. There will be clean countries and there will be the so-called dirty countries. If you're in a clean country, people will be able to travel directly from one clean country to another. And there will probably have quarantines as people move in and out. Dirty countries, where basically the virus has got out of control for whatever reason, will not be able to move around in the same kind of way.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's what's going to happen.
Okay, well, just explain what you mean, Alan.
Well, I mean, William Farr kind of described this when he kind of monitored smallpox outbreaks. Epidemics, you know, follow either a normal curve or a Gompertz curve, with the infection rate dropping from day one. So
The infection rate is dropping from day one.
Yes, the rate of increase is falling from day one, because initially you have a naive population, and not all the population are naive. That one person who's infected can infect the most people, because
Okay, so after a few days or whatever, then a few people who are immune, and there are less and less people.
Yes, so it's progressively less. So it doesn't come at this ridiculous figure like 80%. It comes from slowly developing marginally. So this is where you get this kind of humped curve.
Okay, Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, politically, the government of this country and other countries have basically said we're not going for herd immunity. In fact, nobody's claimed that they are going for herd immunity, not even in Sweden.
I thought the Swedes had.
No, they haven't said that. But in actual fact, politically, they've said we're not going for herd immunity. And, of course, the clean countries I mentioned earlier...
That's irrelevant.
Well, can I just finish? The clean countries we mentioned earlier are definitely not going for herd immunity. They're not going to allow... I mean, in Taiwan, for example, where they've had less than 20 deaths and the virus basically isn't there in the country, they're not going to let anybody into the country at all. And that's what's going to happen, whatever the...
This is a sort of pre-war situation,
because if it's a biological warfare attack on China, just like 9/11, it's part of a warfare, geopolitical
what
warfare.
What about a biological warfare attack by China?
Well, but the question of whether this is a biological warfare attack, we haven't really covered, but I think it is. And I think that's why the Chinese have done what they've done and the way that they've done it. And of course, the same goes for communist Vietnam and communist Cuba. And Venezuela's had a good code. If you look at countries which have done well, they're often countries which have actually got good primary health care, like Kerala in southern India.
Okay, Alan. I mean, Martin's been saying this week after week. What are you saying about these countries?
True. There's no correlation between lockdowns and number of deaths.
We agreed earlier that it isn't about lockdowns. It's about doing the right things at the beginning.
It's not. It's nothing to do with that. Essentially, very little of the variation of COVID-19 deaths per million is to do with the government action. Very little.
Yeah, we have actually covered this already right in the early. One of the things I think I really did pick up this week as a new thing. Slightly new, I suppose. It's something that we've been reminded of from our early days back in February, back on BCFM, before the manager, Pat Hart, removed the programme, and before people were removed from hospitals and put into care homes and died, the elderly, without being tested. We were discussing the idea of there being an AIDS and SARS component to this, and it being a bioweapon, which was a story which was highlighted to the world by Zero Hedge, who were then taken off Twitter the next day for 5 months after that story from the New Delhi University. And we spoke to Greg Felton last week, who's just brought the first book out. I may as well give another plug for that fascinating book about the evidence that this is a man-made virus. He doesn't really know, Martin, and maybe you can just say what you think as to whether it was deliberately released or not.
Well, there's two possibilities. It's either deliberately released or accidentally. Well,
which do you think is most likely and why?
Well, let's just put the three possibilities. It could just be a natural virus. Yeah, it could be a biological developed through gain of function research, which is potentially dangerous anyway. I don't think you should carry out gain of function research on dangerous viruses.
Martin, deliberate or not deliberate?
I think it's probably deliberate. I think it's not designed to kill loads of people.
Why deliberate, though?
Because the Chinese economy is just about to overtake, both technically and in sheer size, the US economy. And pretty clear, Pompeo said the other day, we're not going to tolerate China anymore. We want regime change in China. So they're coming out with all this rhetoric, and then suddenly this stuff arrives in China. And of course, it could have come from the games, the military games that took place. It could have leaked from Fort Larry Romanoff, who's based in Shanghai. Thinks it came possibly from Fort Detrick by accident.
It's not possible it came from Porton Down then.
More likely from Fort Detrick, because of course it may well be, because we're now discovering that there are earlier cases of COVID-19 which have come up, which are not from China.
I mean,
in other words, it could actually have been in the United States. for since the last June, when Fort Detrick was closed down.
What I'm saying is that when I was working for the BBC as a Salisbury reporter in on Wiltshire Sound back in the early 1990s, I did go to a branch of Portendown, which I was told by other journalists afterwards was part of Portendown, even though they said it was part of a hospital. I think it was called the Harvard Hospital on the southern fringes of Salisbury, to do a report on the closure of what was going to be about to be demolished and redeveloped, this thing called the Common Cold Research Centre. Mm. Even though it was supposedly a civilian thing, actually it was being run by nearby Portendown, behind the scenes in the Ministry of Defence, biological weapons place. And that was the main thing they were they're testing their coronaviruses. So I would say it's quite likely that the British have either been dealing with the Americans on these coronaviruses. And it does make sense, Martin, from a biological weapon point of view, doesn't it? Because if you want something that's going to be more contagious than the plague, the first place you're going to look is the common cold.
Or the flu. And the other thing of is what's also suspicious about this is the, you know, the flu, when you get the symptoms, you're infected. Whereas this seems to have a latent phase where you're not, where you can spread it, but you don't show any symptoms. And if you go back to 1918 and the Spanish flu, so called, I think that's pretty clearly a result of, vaccinations for flu. Very experimental vaccinations, which were given at a military base in Kansas, which was definitely the place where it started. And of course, they didn't. I don't think they deliberately infected the U.S. military personnel there. They were just experimenting with vaccines. And just like we've got now, because it's an emergency, we've got a world war on. The Ludendorff offensive has just nearly won the war to the Germans. We've got to get the Americans into the trenches quickly. So they cut corners. And they said, well, let's vaccinate them all again. Because, of course, flu is a major, in trench warfare, people getting flu is a major issue. You don't want, because, you know, it basically ruins the effectiveness of your military. And you can imagine the conditions in trenches.
But it's a perfect live test for a biological weapon.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I don't think they did it deliberately. I think they cut corners and then they covered it up. They knew that these people had been infected with flu, but they didn't tell anybody, and they shipped them all over to the... Because it would have undermined morale completely.
Anyway, so one of the main things
That's the history of that, and that killed more people than were killed in the First World War as a whole.
It's occurred to me, really, this week, again, as I said from earlier on in our discussions back in February, is that with this AIDS element, the potential AIDS element, which has popped up again in Australia today... And was also described by King's College and by the New Delhi University people. So they believe that there's the actual AIDS antigen spike protein on this COVID-19, at least the original one, not necessarily the other strains of it and the mutations that have come out since, that means that this could actually persist in our bodies a lot longer, and maybe causing this long COVID, number one, and also causing these autoimmune diseases, Alan.
Yeah, I mean,
and the worries about autoimmune disease that we've seen just after this vaccine was put in.
Yeah, I mean, flu also does have long flu, so there's nothing really different about.
There's nothing
long
unique
COVID.
About this, no. Is there? And also, we've had, you know, for many many years, we've had these things like ME. Yes, ME, and there are other. Of these diseases, which are basically poo-pooed by many doctors, saying, oh, come on, just pull your socks up. Actually, now they're saying, gosh, you've got long COVID, and there's a whole treatment program for it. Anyway, thanks ever so much, both of you, we're going to try and put COVID behind us now, and we're going to go on. We are going to be looking a little bit at COVID in the second part, because we'll be talking about the Global Vision 2000's report seminar, which took place, their annual eschatology seminar, last weekend, and we'll be hearing from Moeen Yassin, who in his introduction or part of it to that. But in the meantime, let's have a listen to I think is quite a nice jaunty advert for something that might or might not be for sale this Christmas.
Planning for a shite Christmas.
It's finally here. Now that's what I call a Corona Christmas.
I'm socially distant.
The shot in the arm we've all been waiting for.
I've got my gear on.
Christmas hit after Christmas hit.
The lockdown was over.
Lovingly ruined to help you not celebrate this Christmas. Baby, this COVID this long play double cassette CD comes with special 2 meter gaps between every song.
This comes to pass.
Johnny Mathis.
When a mask is worn.
Christmas favorites like
Sanitizer's coming to town.
And even Boris himself.
Ba 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 ba, tis the season to be jolly bloody careful. Tra la 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 la, la 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 la.
And a special message to anyone thinking of venturing out.
Driving's banned for Christmas.
Plus, Frosty got furloughed.
Frosty was furloughed, but he still got loads of cash.
The perfect accompaniment for the party you won't be having.
We're not allowed a party tonight. In case the cops turn up, fight us all £1,000 and kick us all outside.
Plus the biggest event of the year, courtesy of Dominic Cummings.
Cummings drove to da-rum-pa-pom-pom. Grandma's got to quarantine till Christmas, 'cause she flew to Benidorm last week.
Here comes more applause, here comes more applause every Thursday night.
And just released
Pfizer's vaccine.
4 months of school, free school meals, 2 weeks at home, stay up.
The most contagious collection of Christmas songs ever recorded.
Stop the cabinet, stop the cabinet, stop the cabinet briefings.
Now that's a Corona Christmas, the perfect antidote to 2020.
Maybe it's COVID, who's to say? This cough won't go away. Can you stay 6 feet away?
Streaming live now from a 5G phone mask near you.
Ain't no use in the words.
from 2005, the Freemasons, bless them, with Love on My Mind, and also a slightly naughty advert. Now that's what I call Corona Christmas. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're also joined by Alan Brown, local Bristol geopolitical researcher and economist. We're going to be looking at Brexit as no deal looms, disaster or storm in a teacup. I think we'll have differences of opinion between our guests on that one. And if there's no deal, well, whose fault is it going to be? And also, very serious developments over in France with the Macron's government introducing hideous anti-Muslim laws, rather like the anti-Jewish laws in the early 1930s, who were introduced by Adolf Hitler's government in Germany. Quite shocking to see such something going on like this, with all Muslim groups under surveillance and under heavy manners. Basically, a kind of every Muslim group having to have a government license in order to function. And we've already seen some very heavy anti-Muslim laws over in France before. Also, the world's two most powerful men, Kissinger and Schwab, Henry Kissinger, Klaus Schwab, at the World Economic Forum. More from them about how the United States has got to be the world policeman, and particularly when it comes to tracking down who was responsible for COVID. This is rather nasty, since it looks like it might have been the Americans themselves that were responsible. So rather dodgy having them going to track out who... And jail or invade or whatever anyone who was responsible for COVID. I don't think we can necessarily trust their conclusions. Also, the CIA partnering with Google and the Pentagon using artificial intelligence. So everything kind of coming together around the CIA. It's like the CIA again, the spider in the center of the web. Over in the US, dominating the private sector as well as the public if it gets a chance. And the Gulf states all going over to see the Israelis and shaking hands with them and agreeing with them on all sorts of different issues. But finally, a couple of issues that we'll be looking at right at the end is Harry and Meghan having it both ways. So how are they managing to be in and out of the royal family at the same time? The same going on, exact same thing going on with the Duchy of Cornwall. Is it public or is it private? Prince Charles' wealth. It seems to be it's private or it's public whenever it suits him. He swaps about. Norman Baker has a new book out on that. Also, Roland Perry is talking about Victor Rothschild and his role in the creation of the State of Israel. His role as the fifth man after Burgess and McLean, Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, Victor Rothschild. Yes, the last one, and all the inquiries back in the 1970s and 80s into who was the fifth man were run by guess who? Yeah, Victor Rothschild himself. Also, his role in putting the Director Generals into MI5 and MI6, and the relationship with Peter Wright when the Spycatcher book came out. Fascinating stuff from Roland Perry, who's written the book on Victor Rothschild. Basically, the best, by far, biography of him. Roland Perry, I spoke to in Australia earlier this week. And finally, the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. Well, what's that? That's the title of an eschatology seminar, eschatology being the study of the end of the world, which took place last weekend. It was organised by the Muslim think tank Global Vision 2000, and I spoke there at that. But we'll be hearing from one of the organisers, Moeen Yassin, how he introduced these topics. I thought he did an extremely good job summing up what's going on in the world today too, so we'll be hearing from him. He calls it the plandemic. So anyway, we'll start, I think, with Brexit. As you're our guest, I think we should let you say something about that. What do you make of this, Alan? Because we are now in the situation where it's looking more and more likely there's going to be no deal. We had yesterday Ursula von der Leyen saying that they are actually publishing the EU's plans for no deal. And it does look more and more likely because of the disputes over whether there's going to be any kind of vetoes or negotiations over British laws by the EU and also fishing rights. So what do you make of all of this?
Well, obviously the level playing field is the sticking point. But the question is, what is the point of leaving the EU if you're going to have to adhere to the level playing field? And European Courts of Justice rulings on it seems kind of fairly pointless.
Martin, I mean, there are reasons why some people might want to stay in the European Court of Justice, aren't there, and not leave it, because it's going to actually oil the wheels to enable some of the what's been effectively this transition agreement to carry on a bit longer.
Well, I think Alan is right. It is about the level playing field. The fishing stuff is, you know, obviously there's a lot of emotion involved in the fishing, although it only employs 12,000 people in Britain. Debenhams employs more. But of course,
not anymore.
No, indeed. So, in other words, but you know, the issues around fishing are manageable. The level playing field is the thing, and of course, it is the case that if you other countries which are not in the EU, like Norway and Switzerland, are basically still accepting the EU's rules and regs. And we would be the only country.
Well, this is
in
the European Free Trade Area, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah.
But there's a lot of arguments against that as well, Martin. Well, so I don't want to interrupt you, but it is important to understand how that works, because you have to accept the regulations, but you don't get any say in how they're made. That's one of the reasons a lot of Norwegians and Swiss aren't actually happy with that.
Well, a lot of what's actually happened in Norway is they had two referendums to finally join the EU, because they're already in the, you know, they've got to follow the rules and regs, including freedom of movement. And for various reasons in Norway, they just don't want to join. So they've stayed out, but they're basically, they've got to accept the rules and regs. That what will happen with if there is a no deal Brexit, and I don't think it is clear that there will be, but there might be, is that you won't accept the rules and regs. And as Alan rightly points out, if you're going to leave the EU, you can leave the EU and accept the rules and regs. I mean, and in actual fact, in the run up to the referendum, Nigel Farage himself said people who say we're going to leave the single market if we vote to leave the EU are scaremongering. So there is no mandate to leave the single market. That's politically, unless of course you count Boris Johnson's 43% at the last election.
Okay, well, you say there's no mandate, Alan.
I would disagree with that. I mean, I don't think free movement of Labour is the most worrying bit of being an EU member or an EEA member.
No, but surely the main reason why people voted for Brexit was to do with the amount of immigration.
Yes, I'm getting to that. The point is that if you voted to leave the EU because you didn't believe in free movement of labour, then by your de facto, you're saying you want to come out of the single market, because the single market is the four freedoms of labour, of capital, of services, of goods. So if you want to have control of your own borders, I don't believe that's the most dangerous thing about the EU. It's free movement of capital and restrictions on state aid. But if you want to control your borders, then you are de facto asking to leave the single market.
Well, I think the nub of the matter is, do we or do we not want to be in the single market? And the EU position has been all along, You can have access to the single market, but you've got to basically meet our regulatory standards. And if you don't want to do that, you can leave, and that's a no deal. But then, of course, we then preserve the right to put tariffs on your goods.
I mean, there are obviously,
so if you, for example, have looser environmental controls than we've got, and you try and undersell us, because if you have no deal, there's no deal, you don't get access. And but of course, this will kick in as WTO rules on January the 1st, well, which means you've immediately got tariffs, 80% tariffs on beef, 60% tariffs on lamb. That's okay, what Martin, kicks in on
Martin,
January the 1st.
Martin, it seems obvious to me that the European Union and the UK don't seem to be caring too much about the financial implications of this. It seems to be more of a political decision than it is to do with trying to make sure that people in Germany can sell their goods to the UK and vice versa.
Well, what...
I mean, in a way, because it's not... It seems to me that what's being done here is that the financial side of it is being used as a kind of stick to beat people. But actually, the people making these decisions, whether it's Boris or whether it's Barnier, the rest of the EU people, that they are looking to gain politically out of this. They don't really seem to care very much about the people on the ground.
What van der Leyen said last week, and Merkel said as well, is we're not going to make our companies compete with British companies with a hand tied behind their backs. If you want access to our single market, you've got to obey our rules and regs. And if you don't want to have access, that's fine, but that's a no deal.
But I think the problem is, I mean, I haven't got a problem with sort of adhering to labour standards, to environmental standards, on consumer product standards. That's fine. But I don't see how you can have a sovereign country if you give up your right to state aid and control of your financial markets through free move of capital, which is destabilising to financial markets and the economy.
One thing, though, Alan, is that it seems to me that the standards in Britain are rather less than they are in the EU. So we're going to be going down. I mean, for example, so all this talk about chlorinated chicken, that's just one example. But the general standards in the UK, surely less than they are in the EU. Look at the vaccine approval system, for example. I mean, basically, the big pharma seem to entirely control the regulation of the vaccine here in the UK, whereas they don't in the EU. The EU have been actually saying, well, we think that you've been too hasty in approving this Pfizer vaccine, for example.
I mean, one takes us to take a balanced view. That environmental standards now are a worry, I mean, and consumer and some of the drug approvals. But the EU does not have a clean bill of health. After all, Monsanto is owned by Bayer, which is a German company, which makes glyphosate. So it's...
There was also, I mean, in terms of medical regulation, there was the female gel breast implant scandal. And that was all the German regulator, German-based regulator, which is the regulator for the whole of the EU, allowing this gel to be used where it shouldn't have been done, rather like the mesh that was used for female prolapse and for hernia operations in the UK, where the MHRA approved that. And there was a massive scandal about that last year, all incredibly forgotten by... Sorry, I'm getting back to COVID here again. I really shouldn't talk about the vaccine right now. But anyway, one of the other sectors, and I'd love to hear what your view is on this, is the financial sector, as to whether you think actually being free of the European Court of Justice and EU regulation and actually getting our financial policy back to the Treasury and to the Bank of England and to the City of London, Martin, is going to really make any difference?
Well, it's quite clear. I mean, you saw the Commonwealth Bank of Australia moved its headquarters out of the City of London last week, and there's clearly been movement of city firms to open up subsidiaries or move their headquarters inside, you know, even if there is a deal, it doesn't cover services. So the financial services sector is going to be dramatically affected. And, of course, the idea that we, Britain, of course, most of the, we've got Luxembourg and Monaco and places like that which are tax havens, and, of course, Ireland has behaved as pretty much like a tax haven for quite a few decades now. But most of the worst tax havens are actually British dependent territories. And... trying to deal with tax havens is inevitably going to be an international concern. An individual country, even if they had the will,
I mean, look,
finds it quite difficult.
I'm actually trying to get
it.
To a different point, really, which is where we've got the banks seem to be above the law, both in the EU and here. I just wonder where is it going to be the EU or is it going to be here where someone actually starts feeling the collars of these banksters and sticking them in jail?
Well, we know the answer to that. The answer is no. They should have been sent
neither.
To prison in 2000.
Neither in the EU or here.
Yeah, but what you've actually got, if you've got, say we had two jurisdictions, Britain outside the EU and the EU, and you then get basically a competition, a race to the bottom. And of course, we've, as I mentioned, Ireland earlier, I mean, there's a reason why Jacob Rees-Mogg has moved his capital management firm, Somerset Capital Management, or whatever it is, Scam, to Dublin. Because that's, you know, he's trying to make sure that he's going to be there rather than here. But I don't think there's any real attempt. I mean, that people like Varoufakis talk about it. But the problem is that the financial sector is more powerful now than it was in 2008, and that's true in the City of London.
Well, it's certainly
and
true.
In Frankfurt.
And it's certainly true right here in Bristol, because if you've been following this programme for a number of months or years, we've been covering something called the Lloyds cover-up, the Lloyds scandal, the Lloyds fraud, which is where Lloyds Bank have been taking business loans and doing what we call a bait and switch, which is where they say to you, oh, your terms are all going to be better for this loan. You sign on the dotted line, then you find you're not even allowed to have statements to find out how much you owe Lloyds Bank. And their business support unit then destroys you. I mean, it's called business support, but it doesn't do that. And they're based at Castle Park here in Bristol, on the site of the old castle there. And they're not a normal branch, but that's what they're doing. And there's all sorts of allegations of fraud by these people, including things like defrauding clients by forging signatures. And that's a whole nother side of this fraud by Lloyds. Now, it's already been exposed by RBS. And people have actually been prosecuted for that, but not yet Lloyds. And of course, right in the front line of all that is Avon and Somerset Police. And I spoke to one of the organisers of the victims, who was himself actually a government advisor on fraud about 7 or 8 years ago. And his name is Trevor Mealham, and he has put out a bit of a longer video, but I've taken a minute and a half extract from it to give you an idea of what's going on here, because they are accusing people at the police and related to the top of Bristol Police and the Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount Stevens to have vested interests in protecting rather than prosecuting criminals at Lloyds Bank Castle Park.
At the police crime panel meeting, Mrs. Mount Stevens was pushing very much that the BBRS is going to be the way forward. Now, we don't really see how she can say that criminal cases can't be investigated by the police unless she knows that the BBRS has some sort of powers granted by Parliament, but we definitely know that's not the case. So we've got a real problem. We're claiming misconduct on 10 people. We are alleging misconduct by 10 people in the police, very senior police, at Avon Somerset, also on the crime panel of Avon Somerset. And the other thing that we have this report. This was leaked to us by Detective Super Nick Johns of Thames Valley Police. I can't show you the pages of this as the report is being reconstructed, but I can show you that we do have inner content without giving too much finite detail away at this stage. The remit on this was that it was not to include the Acorn Finance victims, and that means that would keep out of the remit a particular solicitors that the current Deputy Police Crime Commissioner of Avon Somerset, Mr. John Smith, used to work at, called Burgess Salmon.
So that's Burgess Salmon, one of the big companies in Bristol, rather in bed with, it seems, that people at Lloyds Bank who are kind of protecting them. Now, the interesting thing about the BBRS he talked about there, Martin, is that this is an organisation a little bit like Action Fraud, so that when there's systematic fraud going on, rather than the police going and detectives going and investigating it, they farm it out to some little quango. And in this case, the BBRS is actually only will ever, only does any, has anything to do with civil actions. So they're formally saying effectively that these kinds of fraud are no longer crimes, even though those crimes are still sitting there on the statute book. They're saying that actually what they much prefer to do is have some sort of financial settlement out of court.
Well, that's what's happened with most of the claims of fraud associated with the 2008 crisis, and basically that doesn't do anything to deter fraud, because organisations like RBS, even if they're found guilty, it's the organisation that pays the fine, such as it is, and the fine, of course, is a fraction of the money that's been made by the fraud that's been conducted. And as Rowan Bosworth Davis, who used to be a fraud squad detective who we've had on here before, points out, that is actually basically a green light to fraud. And what they concluded in general, not, this isn't really Brexit related, is that if they were going to start prosecuting people, they'd have to prosecute everybody, because they're all doing it. And since they can't do that, they're not going to prosecute anybody.
Well, it does seem as if the police are really not doing their job here. They're saying, well, it'd be much rather arrest some sort of homeless cannabis dealer than we would actually go for major criminals who are sitting in Castle Park on our city, allegedly.
Well, indeed. And, of course, the other thing that the police don't investigate is the intelligence services and their role in the drugs trade, etc., etc. This has been going on for years. And, of course, what happens, the whole of the bubble which burst last year is still basically a rerun of 2008, because what 2008 showed, it created massive moral hazard. The too big to fail institutions can basically get away with fraud. And a lot of it could have been, I mean, it is fraud, and if it had been criminally prosecuted, the bank should have been allowed to go bankrupt. The people who carried out the fraud should have been sent to prison. Philip Green, who was the head of HSBC when they were taking money from the Zetas cartel in Mexico, basically was then brought back to Britain to advise Cameron on tax policy. And of course, he's now ended up in charge of Arcadia, which they've looted all of these companies that they take over, and then they don't get prosecuted. He's basically made all of his money out of it, and then this is going on all the time, and we've reached the point where nobody expects anything to be done about any of this.
Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, it's essentially just a form of vulture funding. Is that you force it down the share price, and then you can just buy them on pennies on the door, break them up, you know, raid them. I mean, that's certainly what GRG Group was doing with RBS. I mean, it's kind of they force them. They may not even have any debts to begin with, and they to cover their own debts, you know, the bank's own debts. They force them into near bankruptcy, and then they can load them with fees to make sure they push them over there, and they just sell them off for parts.
Well, one of the fascinating things about this attack on Lloyds Bank is they seem to have their spider web going right across the country, because the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley Police, who represents some of the victims of Lloyds Bank in Castle Park, he has been being under attack for the last 6 months, and also as his deputy has also been under attack. If you go and have a look in the Oxford Mail, lots of complaints about Anthony Stansfield, but he seems to be one of the only police and crime commissioners in the country that's actually making any difference for these people who believe that they have been defrauded by Lloyds. Now, it wouldn't be such a great leap of the imagination, Alan, would it, to see that Lloyds were doing exactly the same as RBS were doing, because these big banks actually learn from each other.
Well, particularly as they took over HBOS, and they took over their liabilities, or should have done, but they didn't in effect. And they, if anything, they were even more egregious than RBS in some instances.
There was a big sort of complaint, an attempt to oust Anthony Stansfield recently. And that is, I'm just looking at the Oxford Mail here, complaint about Police Commissioner Anthony Stansfield is rejected. A group of councillors decided an elected head of Thames Valley Police had not broken any rules following a row over an alleged abuse of power. Last year, Police and Crime Commissioner Stansfield admitted using his work email to warn a private citizen of police action. Well, that sounds quite serious. But in October, Michael Murrin got in touch with the Oxford Mail saying he had been hired by a woman called Michelle Young to retrieve two computer hard drives which contained information. However, the Oxford councillors have decided there was nothing actually to this. And it is interesting, isn't it? So the one Police and Crime Commissioner in the country that's actually doing anything about Lloyds Martin is targeted, and there's an attempt to get rid of him.
Well, it's what you'd expect, isn't it? I mean, we all know that that's what's going on, and nothing has been done about it.
Yeah, well, that in itself, you know, I would imagine involves things like malicious falsehood, which is an imprisonable sentence. Where are the police in all this? And I think that's Trevor Mealham and the people he represents that have been defrauded by Lloyds Bank, allegedly, on Castle Park, would also like to know that. France... this week is now they're debating the introduction of this new law in France against the Muslims. And before we hear an extract from today's programme on the BBC World Service about this, I think it's Ritula Shah and her The Big Story programme. What do you both make of the... Because the French, with Algeria, you first, Alan, the French in Algeria have had lots of migrants, Muslim migrants, and they also seem to have had a big increase in the number of alleged Islamist terror attacks in France. So they are going for some very, very strict rules against Muslims, even though, including things like the clothes they're allowed to wear and all that sort of thing, which is in past years, it's getting even more strict now, apparently, under Macron, or about to. But this, I mean, I have compared this at the top of the hour. I compare this to the attack on the Jews in the 1930s in Nazi Germany. It began as people sort of saying, well, these Jewish people in Nazi Germany, the Jewish people are terrible, they're responsible for this and that. They started bringing in laws and eventually it ended up as a genocide. I just don't like to see this sort of thing going on in France. What do you make of it, the French attitude to things like the hijab, banning that?
It can be dangerous because it seems to be that Macron is under personal attack, the yellow vests and anti-lockdown protests and the change in the change in the rules around the police and filming police and all the rest of it. So he's essentially trying to shift the focus of the attack from him onto another group, which is all never turns out well. It can be very dangerous because it gains a sense of momentum itself sometimes.
Well, this Macron has been outlining his new law to prevent Islamist separatism in France. He's saying that they want to be a separate group. Well, I would have thought they were protected in order to do that. That Muslims can be separate if they wish, and that's part of the protections, Martin, that liberté, égalité, fraternité, actually should guarantee those rights, shouldn't it?
Well, they've obviously had a different interpretation of those rules than we would have in this country. I think underlying all of this is you've got to go back to the war in Algeria in the 50s and the 60s, and even into the 90s, when there was a bomb attack on the Paris metro, which killed, I think, 9 people. And it was blamed on the GIA, the Group Islamic Armée of Algeria, who were the military wing of the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front. But its subsequent investigation showed that it was actually carried out by agents of the Algerian military who were cooperating with the French intelligence services. And, of course, it was the French intelligence services who set up the Safari Group in the 1980s after the Church Committee had started investigating the CIA's behaviour.
Oh, that's famous, that, isn't it? I can remember the guy waving a little gun at the Church Committee hearing, saying, well, we can fire a ICE dart with this, which will go into someone's body, cause a heart attack and disappear.
Yeah, but anyway, but what happened, because they brought in regulations on what the CIA could and couldn't do, but what happened was that the head of the Deuxième Bureau, I think it was, the French Secret Service, got together with the CIA, the Brits and everybody else, and they set up what was called the Safari Group. People can look it up, just do a search on your computer. And the Safari Group was set up to allow the CIA to carry on doing the things it had been doing before, but to subcontract it to other intelligence agencies, specifically the French and the British. And of course, they were the main force behind Operation Cyclone, which created the Islamic International Brigades, which fought in Afghanistan against the Soviets with Israeli weaponry and finance from Saudi Arabia. Now, in other words, a lot of these so-called Islamist attacks in France, especially the big ones, not so much the random nutters with the mental health issues, but the big sophisticated attacks like the Charlie Hebdo attack and the Baclava, the attack on the I can't remember the name.
Charlie Hebdo.
I'm thinking of the more people were killed.
Bataclan.
The Bataclan one. Yeah. Now, these are part of an overall strategy to militarise the society and to demonise Muslims as part of that strategy. And in actual fact, the French secret state has been deeply involved in this kind of thing for a very long time. And you've got a lot of potential for conflict there because a substantial chunk of... I mean, when the war in Algeria ended, the Pied Noir came back to France because they basically they've been there 130 years, some of them, far longer than the State of Israel has existed, by the way, and they all had to leave in the end. Millions, at least a million people died in that conflict.
Well, one of the interesting things about this new French law, it's the Islamist Separatist Bill, it's called, but it apparently doesn't mention Islamism or Islamist anywhere in this bill, although it's a bill which takes the whole idea of Islam out of it, but it's definitely targeted at Muslims. There has been some changes to it since it was originally announced by Macron in October. A clause underlining the necessity for each school-aged child must have a national ID card or number to make sure all are accounted for when are attending public schools, private schools, or being homeschooled. That clause has now disappeared from the text, so that's one thing which is the French government are not going to be getting out of this new law. The law still hasn't actually been published. Only journalists have seen it, which is bizarre in itself. Vast majority of pupils already have a national student ID number, so they've decided to use that instead. The possible controversies, though, the French officials insist the bill is not aimed at Muslims, but it is going to be perceived in that way. There should be no misunderstanding, says an anonymous Elysee official. In no way an action against a religion. It is not against Islam. It's against people in the name of a wrong or reconstructive vision of a religion behave in a way contrary to the vision on the views of the Republic. But MPs from La République en Marche, Macron's party, say they're thinking about introducing an amendment which ban parents from having their young daughters wear the headscarf, for example. So there's a whole load of things in here which should definitely pertain to Muslims. And I'll put a link up on our show page to some of the controversies around this and things like virginity tests, forced marriages and homeschooling young children in basements where girls as young as 3-year-olds are forced to wear the headscarf, or some of the main examples of what Macron and leading government ministers have brandished as cases of Islamist behaviour. But one of the key things which I think is actually quite an important thing to do is they're looking at Saudi money, Martin, coming into France, and also Saudi imams coming into France to take over mosques.
Yeah, well, there was actually a report done in this country when the Lib Dems were in power about who funds extremist ideology in Britain. And it's never been published because, of course, the main funders of extremist ideology around the world are the Saudis in this country and elsewhere. And they, of course, are our allies, and British military are out there in Saudi as we speak, helping targeting for their war in Yemen.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to an extract from The Real Story with Ritala Shah on the BBC World Service today. And here she speaks to one who, a security consultant, who's very much for it. But I found the most fascinating clip is the representative, I suppose, of a kind of equivalent of the Muslim Public Affairs Committee over in France, which explains why he believes that the Muslims have been targeted, all Muslims have been targeted, not just radical Muslims, and some of the facts that we haven't necessarily heard about the attacks over the last few years.
The sheer numbers of people that have become involved in terrorism or, for example, joined ISIS in Syria and Iraq, you can really look at hotspots across France, and when you drill down into those hotspots, what you're seeing is kind of relentless activist networks. So there's really famous networks in Toulouse in southwest France and some of the surrounding countryside. And really, you can trace it back to the activities of a handful of people in the mid-2000s who quite literally went door-to-door as activists, knocking and recruiting for this kind of Salafi jihadist network. You see the similar patterns in Paris with the Charlie Hebdo attackers, the Kouachi brothers. You know, they're not lone wolves. They're not, you know, people who are just radicalized online. They're actually part of networks. There was the Bouchemont network where they were actually training for jihadist warfare in the park in a Paris district. The online element is a part of it, but it's very much a network issue. A lot of what France is dealing with comes from an organization like the Muslim Brotherhood, which started in Egypt in the 20th century. But out of the Muslim Brotherhood's ideology, you had an evolution of what became global jihadism. A lot of Al-Qaeda's leadership actually came from the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East. It's a political theory in the way that fascism or Marxist-Leninism is as well. So it is about conservatism, but it's also an intellectual political belief system as well.
counter-terrorism expert Liam Duffy. So could this new law help to tackle the radicalisation that drives people to commit such atrocities? Yasser Luwati is head of the Justice and Liberties for All Committee, a charity that says it works against racism and state repression. Speaking to the BBC, he alleged that the government itself has failed to define what it meant by radicalisation.
Radicalization does not take place inside mosques. All mosques, madam, are already under surveillance in France. They are all monitored. All the imams are registered. All their sermons are already recorded. Everybody knows radicalization takes place outside the organized communities, in jail, on the internet, in clandestine circles. The community cannot be held accountable for the failures of the government to crack down on radicalization, if it is properly defined, of course, in their own jails and on the internet. And today, more communities are being collectively punished for the very failures of the government. The attacks against Samuel Paty, madam, could have been prevented. The person who killed him had been reported multiple times, at least four times, and most of the time by Muslims themselves. How can Muslims be the first victims of terrorism abroad and the first victims of it at home, even when they do their job to work with the government?
That's Yasser Luwati.
So, yes, and that was Ritul Shah on the World Service today. Fascinating bit of insight there, Martin, saying on the one hand, the French government saying that they're going to have to monitor all the mosques even more, where they're already apparently being monitored. But Yasser Luwati is there saying that actually the real radicalisation is going on outside the mosques, in either in jail or online.
Well, also, of course, some years ago now, people discovered that there was a radical group basically based in a cave in south of France. I think you remember what we're talking about. And it turned out that it was actually being orchestrated by the French Secret Service. And, of course, in the last 10 years in Syria...
Well, surely the French Secret Service was saying we were just keeping an eye on it.
Oh, that's... No, but that's what they say. But, of course, it's absolutely... And, you know, the dogs in the street know that the Western intelligence services have been recruiting Islamist radicals to fight in Libya and to fight in Syria. We know they did that in the 1980s, but they've been doing it in the 2019, you know, the 20-teens. I mean, Shamima Begum, who was, you know, there's a big debate here about whether she should be allowed back to the country, but she was recruited by an agent of the Canadian intelligence services who recruited her online and then persuaded her to go out to Syria to fight against Assad.
Do you think there'd be an uproar if this was being targeting Jews?
Well, I think this is interesting, isn't it? I mean, the idea that you can, for example, the Charlie Hebdo cartoons. If you were to make cartoons like that about Jewish people, it would be regarded as incitement. But if you do it...
Actually, I think in France, you could be probably in prison or jail for that.
And, of course, we're now moving to a situation where anybody who criticises the state of Israel... before Christmas, and there's only a couple of weeks left now, all British universities are supposed to adopt this international definition of Holocaust denial, or whatever it is. But, of course, the reason why most universities haven't adopted it is because it breaks human rights law in terms of saying that what people can and can't say on campus. And Gavin Williamson is saying that he's going to cut off funding to universities which don't adopt the definition.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? So he was talking there about these Islamist training openly in a Paris park. We had exactly the same sort of thing going on here with Islamist terrorists in, I think this was the ones that were involved in the London Bridge attacks, yes it was, in 2017. They were even filmed by a Channel 4 film crew for a documentary and then went on to do an attack.
Well, that's, in my view, is because these clandestine networks, which are the basis of Islamist terror, Salafist extremism, are hand in glove with the Western intelligence services. They have been all along. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group's headquarters, insofar as it's not in Libya, is in Manchester. And the Libyans were the ones who were most... they were recruited mostly from Benghazi by the British and the French to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And the official story is that we set up all of these groups with the help of the Saudis. People have seen the film Charlie Wilson's War, that Hollywood film. And they said, and then suddenly all these people turned against us. We'd trained them for years, we'd helped them fight the Soviets, we'd show them how to shoot down aircraft and blow things up, and then they turned on us. And that's the official story. But in actual fact, we know, and I don't think there can be any dispute about it, that in recent years, we have been working with exactly the same groups in Libya and in Syria to overthrow the secular governments of both of those countries. In Libya, they've succeeded. Whether it's done any good is another matter. But in Syria, they've failed. They've been working with these people. So the first question that I would ask, when you've got a group training in a Paris park, is how many of them are actually working for the state anyway?
Well, it's interesting what he was also saying there is that these exactly the same as has happened with all three attacks in 2017 here in the UK, the Manchester Arena bombing, the London Bridge attack that I just mentioned, and also the Westminster Bridge attack just before the election. Those attacks all just happened, exactly the same. At each of those three occasions, the main protagonists were reported to the MI5 terrorist hotline beforehand, many of them, and exactly as is happening in France, by Muslims themselves.
Well, that's what happened here in Bristol with our homegrown supposed bomber. He used to come to stop the war meetings. I've forgotten his name now. He didn't say much. And he was actually a convert to Islam. His father was Egyptian. He's still in prison. But it was the mosques in Eastern that reported him and said, you need to look at this guy. And of course, what's actually happening is they are creating these Islamist networks. Then they are claiming that they're trying to stop the Islamist networks. I mean, it's quite clear. The Syrian intelligence services are very clear about this. You have created these networks. We are fighting them and trying to get rid of them. And then you claim that you're intervening in Syria to stop these people, because you can't actually get a consensus to try and overthrow the government of Syria. And, you know, most people do not realise how manipulated all of this is. And, it's very easy to create a kind of image of these terrible Muslims doing this, that and the other. I mean, if we were serious about this, why did we invade Afghanistan after 9/11 rather than Saudi Arabia? And of course, the Saudi intelligence services, the Mukhabarat, are working closely with MI6, with the Deuxième Bureau, and they've been working with them for decades. And the whole thing is, and a lot of these Islamist attacks, so-called, like 9/11 couldn't possibly have been carried out by people capturing airliners with what are essentially Stanley knives. There were bombs in the buildings.
Well, this is the box cutters.
Yeah, there were bombs in the buildings. Three buildings went down. There's only one explanation for that. There were bombs in the buildings. As Donald Trump said, the buildings were bombed. And, of course, we haven't discussed what's been going on in the US elections and all the rest of it, all the post-election trauma that they're going through. But the fact of the matter is that the Western intelligence services are the main supporters of Salafist terrorism, as the Iranians and the Syrians are very well
aware. So do you think it's wrong for me to draw comparisons with the beginnings of the Nazis turning on Jews in the 1930s?
No, it's perfectly the creation of a useful enemy for the state is clear. Not only that. I mean, the Jews were in Germany. They may have had some more power than other groups in terms of what. But the actual mechanics of so-called Islamist terror are deeply embedded with the Western intelligence services and military. For example, the British Special Forces trained people how to blow things up. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were trained by our own special forces. As anybody in Belfast will tell you.
I seem to remember that someone from the Special Boat Service that did the training for two of the 7/7 London bombers who were up in Bradford.
Indeed.
And he was taking them over to Cumbria to train them
there. Yes, so we know that the state is so pervasive in Britain that even animal rights groups have had long-term hidden infiltrators in their organisation. And of course the same is true of the so-called Islamist
groups. If you were a cynical person like I am sometimes, you could even say that, well, they've waited until the generation that can really remember the whole Nazi tyranny in Europe are starting to die off before they do the whole thing again over in France.
Well, it's not just in France, is it? I mean, this is a manipulation, a deep state manipulation going back to Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. There was no problem at all during that era of boasting about how we had set up all of these Islamist groups, which were doing a jolly good job of killing Russian conscripts.
So what I'm saying is that the Muslims are the new Jews, and they're hoping that all the people that can remember what happened to the Jews actually experienced it themselves are dead and gone, and that community memory is over.
Well, you will find that many, many Jewish activists in this country are very well aware of the parallel to what's happening to the Muslims, and the Muslim Council of Britain have approached whatever it is called now, the Equal Opportunities Commission or whatever it is, to investigate the Tory Party's Islamophobia, and they presented them with massive evidence that Tory activists at every level are Islamophobic. But of course, because it's basically a government organisation, and they've had their funding cut back dramatically, they've not investigated anything to do with it, even though it's absolutely blatant.
Okay, so
meanwhile, the Labour Party is accused of anti-Semitism for criticising Israeli policy.
So just after they've done a job on the Labour Party, they ran out of money to do it on the Tories. Anyway, so you mentioned Trump there. Just before we hear from Donald Trump talking about his struggle to keep in the battle. And I think it was so interesting. I was chatting to Roland Perry. We're going to hear from later from Australia, this old school journalist over there. He's written this book, The Fifth Man, amongst many others, about Donald Trump. And he reckons, he still thinks that there's an outside 10% chance that Donald Trump may get some of this through to the Supreme Court. He was also pointing out that if, apparently under US law, that if you show that there's been fraud, a substantial amount of fraud in a specific state, then all of the seats in that state will go to the opposite side.
Well, what we're looking at in the US is the rule book being bent all over the place. And I have to make this point. Soon enough, in January the 20th, I think it is, there's going to be a runoff election for the Senate in two senators for Georgia. If the Democrats win both of those seats, they will have control of the Senate. Now, that suggests to me that the Senate elections in the US are rigged in the sense that each state gets two senators. So the state of Wyoming, which has got a very limited population, gets two senators. California, which is basically a country in itself, only gets two senators. So the fact that the Democrats have got a chance to control the Senate shows that in actual fact they've got more support than the Republicans. And what Trump is trying to do here is get the Electoral College to give him the victory. But I don't think anybody has shown me that in actual fact they won the majority of the votes.
Also, there's a certain amount of sour grapes from Trump in that the Democrats have done a fine job in making sure that all Democrat votes are counted, because previously there'd been these great long queues where people didn't get a chance to vote.
Yes. And the other thing, of course, is what gets me about Sidney Powell is that if she was to come out and say,
this is Trump's illegal advisor.
Well, yeah, but she's they've cut her loose, so she's a loose cannon now. But obviously she's involved in networks of people like Steve Bannon and so on. And she's saying, if they came out and said, we think the CIA have stolen this election, I might be prepared to listen to them. But they're not. They're saying it's the Chinese Communist Party, the Iranians and the Venezuelans who've stolen the election.
Well, maybe if she used to say that, she might be in a car.
And of course, what I'd also say to the people who voted for Trump is Trump said on 9/11 itself, or the day after, these buildings were bombed. He was right. Because there's no democracy in the US.
And I think
it's run by the deep state.
It's a pretty simple job to say to anybody that uses electronic voting, well, that election was rigged. Anyway, let's hear from Trump now.
If you're rich, it doesn't matter. I'm doing this for the country. I'm doing it for the people that show up. I haven't had an empty seat at a rally. I always say, where's the rally? It's in a certain place. Okay, just get the biggest arena. I go into these massive basketball arenas like in Dallas where the Mavericks play. And fill it up and set a record. I've set a record almost every place I've been because we just need a little small stage. We don't need basketball courts, ice hockey courts. And I take less than musicians because they have bands. I don't have band. I've set the world record for somebody without a guitar, okay? I don't have bands, right? So that's the story. And you know, those people are the poll. And I've had great polls. I've had my best polls now. I think it's because people think that it's terrible what they're doing. Pelosi, Shifty Schiff, Schumer, these people are trying to destroy the country. It's a very bad thing what they're doing. The President of the United States should be allowed to run the country, not have to focus on this kind of crap, while at the same time doing a great job on Syria and Turkey and all of the other things that we're doing. North Korea, okay, maybe someday, but I'll tell you what, if somebody else became president with that same mindset that they had, you'd right now be in a big war with North Korea. You don't hear too much about it. Could happen. Could happen. I don't know. I always say, who knows? It's deals. Who knows? But in the meantime, North Korea's, I like him. He likes me. We get along. I respect him. He respects me. You could end up in a war. President Obama told me that. He said, the biggest problem, I don't know how to solve it. He told me he doesn't know how to solve it. I said, did you ever call him? No. Actually, he tried 11 times. But the man on the other side, the gentleman on the other side, did not take his call. Okay? Lack of respect. But he takes my call. Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay, that's Donald Trump there speaking. So he sounds like he's going down fighting anyway.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm following this fairly closely. But as I say, even if they were to prove that the CIA fiddled at voting machines, they've still got a fundamental problem, which is, and Trump himself has admitted this, that if we don't stop this kind of postal voting and so on, we're never going to get Republicans elected in this country ever again. Because ultimately, the demographics are moving against the Republican Party. Ultimately, the nation is becoming younger, more Latin American. The only reason that they're able to dominate the political system is because it's been designed to entrench the power of rural white America. And that was deliberate. It's not an accident. It's not a democratic system.
Okay. Well, anyway, there's been quite a few stories to do with this, I suppose we would call the deep state intelligence services and et cetera this week. Also, the U.S. Department of Justice is launching a probe into Hunter Biden's tax affairs amid calls for special counsel. That's RT reporting that. We've also got the Pentagon's top spy agency turning to artificial intelligence for targeting and operations planning. Great, reminiscent of the 1983 sci-fi classic War Games, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency's new Mars program, aims to create a system that uses AI to scour volumes of foreign intelligence and make decisions of how to act on it. So rather than human beings being involved on, you know, where some war should go, which direction it should go or not, that's Mint Press News reporting that. But also, and possibly most worrying, Martin, is the CIA is now doing an official partnership with Google, Amazon and IBM in a big tech procurement drive. The military-industrial complex is returning to its roots, they say, as the CIA turns to big tech to maintain control and rebuild the war economy.
Well, they've been in cahoots forever, haven't they? It's hardly news to those who are paying attention. The whole creation of the internet was essentially on the back of Pentagon spending, and Bill Gates was given control of it on the understanding that he would give a backdoor to the intelligence services.
What's interesting about this is they're formally now saying it. Well, it's Amazon is going to be part of the CIA. It's a bit like the amazing news last year that the World Economic Forum is doing a hostile takeover of the United Nations. These groups, which we've suspected for many, many years, are working together. It's now official policy. It's now out in the open. Rather also like the Gulf states are now working with the Israelis very closely, even though they're supposed to be Arab states.
Well, yes, I mean, lots of things are happening very quickly in various spheres, aren't they? There's the economy, there's the geopolitics, there's the outright, whatever you think about vaccines or not, the fact that Brigade 77, paid for by the British taxpayer, over 1,000 people work for it apparently, are spending time trying to destabilise anti-vaccine groups. That is what British defence spending is being used on. And so, in a sense,
does that include the doctors?
Well, it could include anybody. What's actually happening is that the deep state is coming out into the open and basically saying, yes, we need the powers we need to deal with COVID, to deal with Islamist terrorism, to deal with anti-vaxxers, whatever.
Well,
the gloves are coming off.
One
and the mask
gigantic
slipping.
Bombshell in all of this is the massive involvement of the Bilderbergers with the whole COVID-19 crisis. And on WikiSpooks, there's quite a nice list there, which I'm afraid even missed out a couple of the Bilderbergers involved. The two I would say are the main ones, actually, are Emmanuelle Charpentier with her gene editing laboratories, which are very much working in cahoots with other of these human genetic engineering companies. And she was at Bilderberg in 2016. And of course, Henry Kissinger, who's been, he's basically threatened or warned the world that unless we have a united response, and of course, he's got his various people that he wants to run that united response around the world to COVID-19, then the world could go up in flames. Now, I'm not sure quite whether that's a warning or a threat from Henry Kissinger, but those are two, the WikiSpook site names some more. Tom Tugendhat, who was at Bilderberg in 2019, he's a UK MP, in November 2020 suggested that COVID vaccination should be mandated for UK workers and travellers. Also in Bilderberg 2019, last year over in Switzerland, at Mount Perelon, I think it was near Lake Geneva somewhere, I'm not quite sure, I can't remember exactly what lake it was, but it's in Switzerland anyway. Matthew Pottinger, he's a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Vittorio Coalo, he's a leader, and she was at Bilderberg the year before in 2018, a leader of a special task force to handle phase two of the Italian COVID task force. Dennis Hassabis, also 2018, 2016 and 2015, he's been at Bilderberg quite a lot, hasn't he? Dialed into a meeting of SAGE, which promoted the UK COVID lockdown. Avril Haines, 2017, the UK deep state actor who participated in Event 201, the holder of senior spooky positions in the US deep state connections, Event 201 being a rehearsal that took place in October, November 2019, a pandemic very much mirroring the actual pandemic, which then took place in 2020. And then there's Christopher Liddell, who was at Bilderberg in 2017, the White House Coronavirus Task Force member. Dido Harding, it was 2016, at the meeting I went to over in Dresden, in charge of producing the widely condemned NHSX app mass surveillance tool. And Shiraz Maha, 2015, a terror expert. He was at Bilderberg in 2015, who stated in March 2020 that COVID-19 was completely mad, crazy illness. It has made me feel more intensity than I've ever been in my life. That's what he said. Anyway, I'm not sure quite how that's linked to really into the policy to do with COVID-19. Maybe that's just a little humorous comment that he's made. Anyway, Andrew Liveris he's a special advisor, and he was at Bilderberg in 2012 to the Australian National COVID-19 Coordination Commission. And finally, although there may be more, we'll just see as this list increases. I'll put a link up to the WikiSpooks list on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Kathleen Sebelius, and she was at Bilderberg in 2017 and 2008. And she is on Joe Biden's White House Coronavirus Task Force. So quite a lot of links between these Bilderbergers, Martin, and they seem to have been popped into many positions which are making policy now.
Well, it was ever thus, isn't it? I think you mentioned Mont Pelerin there earlier. And, of course, you know the Mont Pelerin Society?
Yes.
Perhaps Alan could say something about the Mont Pelerin Society.
Well, the Mont Pelerin Society was set up just after the Second World War, after Keynes comprehensively destroyed neoclassical theory. So it was a reinvention of neoclassical theory plugged into macroeconomics.
So it was a sort of 1940s Great Reset?
Yes. So it was an invitation-only group. And so the idea was to create a narrative for neoliberal economics and some Austrian economics, there were variations in the types, the type of neoliberal economics, depending on the German type, French type, or the American type. They had slight variations initially. They tend to coalesce around the more the American model.
Yeah, it's Lake Geneva, more parallel, and that's where the Bilderbergers met last year, with Mike Pompeo making an appearance. This year, apparently, they didn't meet. Do you believe that, Martin? I mean, maybe at least the steering committee would have met, I would have thought.
Well, I imagine.
They don't like meeting on Zoom, that's for sure.
Well, I imagine they've got their own secretive WhatsApp chats, haven't they?
Because they know that everybody listens to Zoom, whatever is going on. I'd imagine that, you know, most intelligence services have got some sort of, certainly Western ones have got some sort of backdoor into Zoom, and so they wouldn't necessarily want to be listened to, would they?
Well, the Chinese have got a backdoor into Zoom because they invented it, so.
The backdoor.
Mm.
Okay, so so let's also have a look. Whilst before we go off from looking at the US particularly, and the Bilderbergers were the main funders and starters of the US were the main CIA actually. One of the sections of the CIA was responsible for funding the original Bilderberg meetings, and also MI6 were very much involved with that. The War and Peace Studies Group, it was in 1943, would you believe? Several years before the end of World War II, they were already planning for what the post-war world was going to be. A chap called William Turbitt. Now, he's US blogger, with his YouTube channel. He's just had it put yanked, the whole channel yanked. And he believes that it was to do with the US elections. He was doing quite a lot of commentary on Hunter Biden and on scandals to do with his hard drive, various other things. But he was particularly annoyed that many years of work has all been disappeared. And he's busily re-uploading most of his material to YouTube and other platforms. But I had a chat to Will about what it was that it was actually censored from his channel, because this, I think, is the most interesting question to ask, since we're getting so much pulled off of YouTube by YouTube. What is it that they're concentrating on getting rid of? Because this, I think, is probably what we need to know the most.
Sure. Then this, I think, is very, very important as far as Pizzagate's concerned, because for anybody that wasn't in the trenches or didn't really know what was going on, Pizzagate was, if you go look up Pizzagate on Google, it's going to tell you that it's a debunked conspiracy theory, which basically said that Hillary Clinton was trafficking children out of the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., but that's actually not what Pizzagate was. That's a total straw man. So what Pizzagate is a name for what people like myself and others have been talking about for a long time. And I did another show, and this is basically the content of my work. But if you take a look, the Rothschilds, Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, Sir Evelyn Rothschilds, they're all together. They're connected with Jeffrey Epstein, Tamara Lozado. You got the Rockefellers, Wilbur Ross, which connects him to Trump and Epstein again. Lynn Forrester de Rothschild introduced Prince Andrew to Jeffrey Epstein. And then these people are also, you know, part of the Super Friends and Bilderberg and so forth. And then they connect to the Rockefellers, who also connect right back. You've got James Alefantis, who is a pizza shop owner, but he was named by Washington Magazine as one of the 50 most influential people in Washington, D.C. But, well, we have 50 senators, 435 congressmen. We got a president, we got a Supreme Court down there. And really what Pizzagate is, I guess to sum it up, is things that you would think would be totally separate from each other, like the Rockefellers, the Rothschild, the Nexium cult, James Alefantis and his disgusting R-rated Instagram, even though he pretends to have a family-friendly shop. You have the John of God cult, Weinstein. You have the intelligence agency, Bill Gates, Marina Abramovich, all tucked in there. And another thing that I had, just to put a little bow on this, is I've actually went down myself to Comet Ping Pong Pizza a number of times. And I went down there one time, and there was an impromptu protest, and I caught people, and it will be re-uploaded because thankfully I did have somebody out in Ireland back up all my videos, so I have them. And I'm re-uploading them now, but I caught people, some of the patrons there at Comet Ping Pong Pizza, hailing Satan multiple times on video. And then James Alefantis I went, returned at a later date, saw him in the back alleyway, have it all on video, got his phone number. I actually look much younger than I am. I look like a very young man, possibly even underage sometimes. And he got my number, and he was like, yeah, the sex stains are coming back to his restaurant. And the sex stains and heavy breathing make these pedophilic jokes, and they seem to have no problem performing for a family-friendly audience. So I guess to make a long story short, the real Pizzagate is the connections between the world's elite and their penchant for child abuse.
Well, there's Will Turbitt summing it up, Martin. You know, interesting, isn't it, that as the final dots are put together about the powerful elite, I mean, this is really an elite which was described by C. Wright Mills in the 1950s as basically above the law, the super rich that use their wealth to gain more and more and more political power, actually connected up with some of these really evil activities.
Well, it's, you know, the use of... you know, paedophilia as a means of controlling elites. This is ultimately what the Epstein affair is all about.
A lot of the girls were not underage, you know, some of them weren't underage, and certainly few of them, as I understand it, were actually below the age of puberty.
Yeah, all right, but I mean, the point is that it's embarrassing and difficult. So if you've got people, I mean, the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, for example, it's another aspect of this. The MI5 were using that; they were getting. People, targets that they wanted to blackmail to go in there and have sex with underage boys, and they were videoing it and photographing it and so on. I mean,
and surely there are people that actually enjoy this stuff. It's not just an entrapment operation. There are people who can hide within the intelligence services, with the protection of the intelligence services, who have an evil penchant to do this.
That you're missing the point. That may be so. I mean, if you look at that was MI5 that were doing that, and the culture of the British intelligence services was very heavily influenced by, it wasn't called gay in those days, but homosexual culture. And don't forget that homosexuality was completely illegal in this country till 1967, and then the age of consent was afterwards still 21. So it's quite easy to, and of course many people like Sir Maurice Oldfield were gay, you know, but I mean, and of course,
Peter Heyman, he was the deputy director of MI6, and he was had pictures of child pornography.
Yeah, and you could say,
in fact, he was having sex with underage boys.
Yes, but I mean, but the point is that it's not just that they've got these evil penchants; it's because it's useful, it's blackmailable. I mean, Whitney Webb's done some really good stuff on the Epstein affair. And what's been going on there? I mean, Epstein was working for Mossad, as was Ghislaine Maxwell and her father, Robert Maxwell.
Okay, well, anyway.
So what we're talking about here is Israeli intelligence blackmailing senior politicians.
What Will's talking about there, though, is these rings based in the United States. And I am particularly aware that we have a similar pattern of behaviour of tearing up international law being done by the United States over the last 20 years or so. Before that, obviously, as well, but really intensely since the September the 11th attacks. And this is rather similar to the Nazi Germany. And as a result of all of that, you know, I'm concerned that we've got a kind of elite which is way above any kind of sense of prosecution in the United States. And we're about to have a big change of government there, too.
Well, it's not a change of government. I mean, Biden is a deep state creature. As is to a certain extent,
I think
Trump.
Probably Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum would agree with you, as would Henry Kissinger, who we're going to hear from now about the US's role in the world.
Couldn't you say the US becomes more and more a pragmatic, realistic, legalistic society, missing the normative, the value-based, the idealistic dimension? And I think this dimension was so important to provide the U.S. with credibility in international leadership.
No, I think the idealistic element of America is inseparable from the American role in the world. And you cannot justify foreign policy in America in the long term simply by a balance of power approach or a purely legalistic approach. And indeed, I would say that a very significant element in the United States is distorting things by an excessively, I wouldn't say idealistic approach, but an excessively moralistic approach. I think the neoconservative element would certainly be that. And then there are many people with whom I sympathize from my own experience who believe that America has a moral duty to intervene militarily wherever human rights are seriously violated. That is a very significant element in the American debate. The present debates are about finances, and they, of course, have a major legalistic element, but they will come down to one question. In the name of what can America ask sacrifices of its people? It will have to ask sacrifices. And I think it will, after it works through the present process. And so that is really an idealistic debate, another legalistic debate.
So, idealistic. He's talking a little bit round the houses there, but he's also saying that that the United States people have got to suffer, and he's giving at least some credence there to these people in the US who are saying that the US has a moral duty to around intervening in the world where they see human rights. The only trouble is, of course, that often it's the US that's violating those human rights in the first place. But the main point really with these two, Martin, is they both almost like kind of gurus. You know, they're extremely super rich, and Kissinger has got fingers in the pies of both the United States and in China.
Well, I think the idea that they're all in it together, the Chinese Communist Party and the United States elites, I think there are elements within the Chinese leadership which would like to have a constructive relationship with the West, but they have been marginalised because of the attitude of the Cold Warriors like Kissinger. And Kissinger, of course, famously took Nixon to China to try and pull the Chinese away from the Russians, or the Soviets as they then were, which they didn't have to do very much of, because basically the Chinese had already broken with the Soviets by that stage. They are, you know, I mean, what makes me, you know, I'm sitting here almost throwing up when they keep going on about idealism of the United States. I mean, that is just so crap. I don't know where to begin to. I mean, the idea that somebody like Kissinger has got idealism about the role of the United States, and what that comes down to is this whole exceptionalist Stan stuff, you know, with the exceptional country, which are there to, I mean, they used to claim that the USSR was dangerous because it was the only country in the world which didn't have any limit to its power. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics could basically be a global thing. Whereas, of course, it's the Americans, and the United States in particular, which feel that they have a right and a duty to intervene everywhere in the world. They want full spectrum dominance on every planet, on every continent.
Well, on every planet, and in
outer space, yeah.
Anyway, so we'll move on now to look at the royal family, and there's some terrific stuff from Norman Baker. He's the MP that did the investigation into the first major investigation book into the death of Dr. David Kelly at the time of the Iraq War. The book is What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know, and the title is And What Do You Do? This is his book, so let's hear from him straight away. Now, he does talk about Harry and Meghan, but more interestingly, he's done quite a lot of digging into Prince Charles, our neighbour up at Highgrove in Gloucestershire here. And it's certainly looking increasingly likely, Martin, that Prince Charles is going to take on this global role with the Great Reset and with being able to be completely open about his politics and his environmental enthusiasm, and hand on, be seen to be very magnanimous next April, and hand on as Prince Regent to Prince William when the Queen retires.
Well, I don't know about that, Tony.
What would you make of that?
Well, I don't know whether I'd
surely,
believe it.
Surely the royal family, the idea, whole idea of them is that they're not allowed to be political or partisan, are they?
Well, in theory, well, we all know historically the royal family has had various political... I mean, everybody was pretty clear that Queen Victoria liked Disraeli, who made her Empress of India, and she didn't like Gladstone, who opposed intervention in Afghanistan. So, you know, they've always had a political role. The question is...
How open have they been about it? Well,
yeah.
Prince Charles has always been very open about it, so it does look as if Prince Charles might like is the idea that he will get a lot of cachet from the public if he says, you know, I'm going to be magnanimous and hand this to William. He'll be respected by the public.
Well, I'll believe that when I see it, Tony, to be honest. We shall see what happens with that. I think the thing about him hanging out with Schwab and all the rest of it, the idea that these people have the interests of the environment at stake, there is a huge load of scam about that. I mean, basically, poor peasants in Brazil do not need allies like the Prince of Wales. It's absurd. And in actual fact, this whole idea that the Great Reset... You see, the right wing in the US see the Great Reset as some kind of socialist conspiracy. But in actual fact, of course, it's the same old people who are now going to be... Just as they intervened in Latin America and in Chile to... You know, we can't let a country go communist because of the irresponsibility of its own people. They're now going to intervene in the developing world to save the planet from global warming.
Okay,
but it's basically just the same people with the same agenda to keep the multinationals and the financial sector in the West ticking over.
Shift a few trillion on the old roulette table from one of the coins to another coin, from black to red. Anyway, so Norman Baker now on Prince Charles.
A lot of money which has come from the Duchy of Cornwall has gone to Harry and Meghan, as well as to William and Kate. But here's the thing, of course, when we're told that money comes from Charles, if it comes from the Duchy of Cornwall, that's money that comes from us,
yeah.
Because the Duchy of Cornwall, in my view, is a public body.
Yes.
And certainly when Prince Charles pays them out of the Duchy of Cornwall, what he does is he offsets the money he gives them against tax. So we're losing out that way, yeah, as well. If it's a private estate genuinely, why is it paying no corporation tax?
Right.
He calls it private when it suits him, he calls it public when it suits him. Mm. But, you know, each member of the royal family, any senior member of the royal family, it's worth at least £20 million.
Right.
Probably a lot more. Charles, I estimate, in my book, it's worth £100 million. Mm. Well, where's that money come from? It's come from one of two reasons, either directly or historically. It's come from either taxpayers' money being handed out, or it's come from tax breaks available to the royal family, not available to anybody else. There's worse to come, I think, because the net's slowly closing in on Andrew. I think Harry and Meghan will get more extreme than they even have done so far, and more upsetting to the British public. But, you know, for me, the real scandal of the royal family is the finances. They are coining it in at a time when everybody else has been tightening their belts. Mm. They are coining it in. Just one statistic, if I may. In 2010, the civil list gave the Queen $7.9 million.
Right.
The equivalent sovereign grant in 2018, to less than 10 years on, was $82.3 million.
Blimey.
Tenfold increase.
That's not bad, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're paying £359 million to refurbish Buckingham Palace. They're paying nothing for that.
Mm.
But yet the Queen is collecting and keeping the income stream from the tickets sold to visitors to go into the palace. Nice non-work if you can get it.
Well, exactly right. Blimey.
So that's Norman Baker, former MP, former minister, and the coalition government. Martin, this is awful, isn't it? Because the main thing that he's pointing out here is that they're using a rather sneaky sleight of hand to move things between or Prince Charles's, between the Duchy of Cornwall and the Crown Estate. So when it looks like he's going to have to pay some money, it goes out of one and not the other, and one that doesn't get taxed. So, or he'll offset it against tax. So there's a lot of sleight of hand going on here. Now, what do you make of the property of Prince Charles? Is it public or private?
This is an interesting question, isn't it? Because when William the Conqueror came over in 1066, all land in the country was basically given to him as the feudal lord, and then he gave it out to various people, his retainers.
Well, I know he would say is that he would say this is God's land and I'm God's representative, so it's mine.
Indeed. But I mean, the point is that everything in theory belonged to the crown. And so
well, Kevin Cahill would say it still does, doesn't he?
Yeah, but the Duchy of Cornwall, for example, is you know, you could argue that all of these things, if say we were to vote to have a republic, then all of the revenues of the crown should revert to the public purse,
to the treasury.
And so, you know, as it's very interesting that Norman Baker has picked up on all of these anomalies that he's obviously written his book about. But and another thing that just apropos of, you know, just a slight aside, I was remember reading a couple of weeks ago that Rishi Sunak's wife is richer than the Queen.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. This is Goldman Sachs. Is it Goldmine Sachs?
Well, yes. I mean, you ask, where did that, I mean, in actual fact, it's because her family are wealthy entrepreneurs in India. But
anyway, there's a lot more in that book. It's called And What Do You Do? By Norman Baker, What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. Great title. Well done, Norman. And our penultimate item tonight is Roland Perry. He's an Australian journalist I spoke to earlier this week, who's written the biography of Victor Rothschild. I particularly disliked Victor Rothschild because of his role in sacking the Director General of the BBC in 1987, Alistair Milne. And Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the BBC, in his biography called Chance Governs All, which is a bit of a sneaky and a incorrect title, really, because he was saying the opposite. He was doing the opposite in most of his activities. He was making sure that things were being manipulated. He was married to the, when he was alive, back in the 80s, he was married to the chief lady-in-waiting to the Queen, so he was obviously very closely connected with the court and the royal family, as was Victor Rothschild. And Victor actually sacked, it was Victor really was behind the sacking of the Director General, as Marmaduke Hussey makes it clear in his autobiography, Chance Governs All. So I was fascinated to hear what Roland Perry had to say about all this, and particularly about Victor Rothschild's role as the fifth man. Now, Martin, you know, you will probably remember, as many people who were around in the 50s, 60s, 70s will, the Cambridge spy scandals with Burgess and Maclean, first of all, defecting. They basically disappeared from London and popped up in Moscow a few years later and did a press conference. Then it was Kim Philby, who was a journalist, and they pushed him out to Beirut because they didn't want him out of access to any secrets in London. So rather than prosecute him, he was suspected of being a Russian spy for Stalin during the war and during the Cold War, but he was shoved over to Beirut. And then it was Anthony Blunt. Now, this got very, very close to the royal family. This is a guy that hung out in Buckingham Palace the whole time, and he was the curator of the Queen's pictures. So it was always a bit of a mystery as to who was the final one in the ring, because there was a lot of I've never seen the actual original stuff about this, but apparently the British intelligence were picking up stuff from the Russians that made it clear that there were five major spies, and no one was quite sure who the fifth one was. Victor Rothschild was very clever in blaming Roger Hollis, who was the Director General of MI5, for being a spy, where actually it was Victor Rothschild himself who was the spy. So anyway, a marvellous job that Roland's done with this book, published in the 1990s, and I managed to track him down in Australia, where the first thing I asked him, really, or one of the first things, what we're going to hear from now, is about what he thought his role was, Victor's role, in the creation of the State of Israel.
This whole episode spans, and Victor Rothschild's life spans, the creation of the State of Israel. Do you think he had a role in that?
Huge. Number one. He got the Russians to vote for the development of the State of Israel. Australia did. We had a good affinity with the Israelis, and we backed it. But if you look at the roll call, the United Nations had stood up and said, we want Israel developed and so forth in 1948, this was. Australia was in, Russia was in, and that was Rothschild's payback. He just told Stalin, you have to do it effectively because we've done so much for you, you do it. And, you know, it was tied up in the anti-Nazi thing, they'll have to use all that. So you know, Victor created their entire intelligence network. I have that in the book, but that's absolutely correct. They're beholden to him for that. And
so didn't they have something called the Haganah before? It was during World War II, and then that was turned into the Mossad in 1948. Well, probably a few years after 1948.
Yeah, they're a pretty effective. They've just killed that Iranian, I would say. I don't know, but it looks like they murdered those, they've killed two of them now who are developing nuclear weapons. I mean, all the blocks about the Iranians not developing nuclear weapons and the stupid deal that Obama and company did, absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, well, that's a biggie. You know, most people seem to say that the Iranians don't have nukes, but the Israelis do.
Of course they do. Of course, the Israelis have them. I mean, but the Iranians have them on. They're building them all, and they haven't stopped. It's total rubbish. Look, the Mossad wouldn't worry about bumping anyone off if there was nothing happening. But that's beside the point. We're talking about Rothschild. He started that network, intelligence network, and that was part of the deal that he would set that up, and he did, and it's been very effective. Just as a sidelight, my good mate Jack fought for the British in the Middle East, and then when the fight for Israel had been developed, he joined the Haganah. So he was fighting against the Brits, effectively. He's no one more British than good old Jack, but he did have the dual operation there. He went over and fought again in the Middle East, this time against the British to help set up the State of Israel. And the Brits didn't want Israel for one particular reason. They weren't anti-Semitic. That's ridiculous. They wanted it because they had such terrific contacts in the Middle East and setups in Saudi, Lebanon, everywhere, Syria from World War One. They did not want a rogue state implanted into the middle of the Middle East that they had no control of. And that's why they were very much against the development of Israel.
So it's Roland Perry there, the author of the biography of Victor Rothschild, The Fifth Man. Martin, one of the most fascinating things he's talking about there is you've got people working with the Brits one minute and the next minute they're working against the Brits.
Well, Ord Wingate, who set up the Chindits, which is the original Brigade 77, which is why the British Army unit is called Brigade 77, because it's the Chindits, he basically set up the Haganah. And he was working very closely with the Israeli terrorists, which is what they were. I'm not quite sure that I agree with him about what's going on with the nuclear weapons in the Middle East, but there you go. I think one thing I will mention, which I've seen this week, and I don't think you've probably picked up on it, Tony, did you realise that a senior Mossad leader was assassinated 2 days ago in Tel Aviv? Somebody just walked up to him while he was parking his car at a red light and blew his brains out.
Well, this is funny, isn't it? It reminds me a little bit of the US officer's helicopter or aircraft was shot down just after the Soleimani assassination.
Inside Afghanistan, yeah.
So it may be that what's happening here is as the US is making a big media furore about people being assassinated in Iran, that the Iranians are actually managing to assassinate people back it being covered in the media.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to check this, I was going to send you...
Of course, that sends a very strong message to the military.
I'll send you, when I go home, I'll trace it, because it was actually on New Eastern Outlook, which I got it. But there's a video of the aftermath of the shooting. Yeah, so all of these... You know, police cars turn up. He's obviously dead in the car. Yeah. Now, of course, the Iranians won't claim that, just as they didn't claim the assassination of this other guy that they blamed for the assassination of Soleimani. And the message they're sending to their opponents in Mossad is, yes, you can kill our top people and you could even boast about it, but we are going to come to find you where you are and we're going to blow your brains out.
Do you believe it?
I think it's quite likely that's what the Iranians are doing, and of course they're not going to boast about it, and then if you say to them, did you do that, they'll say no comment.
That's exactly what the Israelis say when they assassinate people.
Well, exactly, I mean, but what the Iranians are doing is playing them at their own game. It's a very dangerous situation. I mean, the assassination of whatever his name was, the nuclear scientist, is... This is Trump. Trump has done... I mean, Trump basically retweeted the idea that he'd been assassinated, basically taking credit for it. And of course, it'd be very interesting to ask Keir Starmer What is your position on the assassination of nuclear scientists in Iran? Is it anti-Semitic to question whether that was the Israelis or not? Come on, you used to be director of public prosecutions. What do you do when people are assassinated like that? And it looks as if he was assassinated by a very sophisticated, the Iranian, by a robot machine gun, which then exploded. High tech.
This is pretty shocking stuff. But anyway, let's have a listen now again to Roland Perry talking about Victor Rothschild's general role with the spies. I just think that it's, I mean, Martin, it's incredible, isn't it? That, you know, you've got, is it really possible to assassinate one of the top people in Mossad with no press coverage at all?
Well, it's got coverage on New Eastern Outlook, and it's definitely out there. I mean, both sides have got an interest in not, and the Israelis don't want to talk about it.
There's an article by Vladimir Platov.
That's the one. There's a Twitter
video. New Eastern Outlook saying, has the VIP killings duel between Iran and Israel begun?
Yeah.
The insidious murder of a leading Iranian nuclear physicist, Mohsin Farakadzeh, on November the 27th in a Tehran suburb does bode ill for its apparent insight as an assassin. So far, numerous media outlets have emphasized the possibility of consequences and developments in the Middle East situation. Will Iran be able to keep silent about the provocation by Israel? If earlier, aside from Tehran's confidence in direct guilt of this murder of the Israeli special services with the US behind them, other states and the media preferred not to speak openly about Tel Aviv and Washington's involvement. This is Ronan Bergman, they also say, an Israeli journalist working with the Aronoth newspaper and contributing writer to the New York Times, former deputy director of the Mossad and now a Knesset member, and Viktor Ostrovsky, a former Mossad agent who became world famous after his bestseller By Way of Deception, Making of a Mossad Officer, was published in 1990. So he's really talking in this article about, is it really possible to keep this out of the news?
Well, it is if both the Iranians and the Israelis, who've got very, I mean, the Israelis in particular, have a great deal of influence in Western media. They don't want to let the cat out of the bag that their guy's been assassinated, and the Iranians don't want to openly take credit for it. But of course, this is gangsterism, basically. Do you know what I mean? It's what the Russians call the razborka.
Against all this background, it became known on the 6th of December in Tel Aviv as a result of an armed attack. One of the high-ranking Israeli intelligence officers, Mossad commander Fahmi Hinavi, was killed, according to media reports. 15 bullets were fired into the intelligence officer's vehicle when he stopped at a red light. It is speculated the attack could have been Tehran's retaliation.
Well, that's what I read earlier in the week.
So I think, yeah, we'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. 10 out of 10, Martin, for noticing that one. But anyway, we'll go back to Roland Perry now to hear what he makes of Victor Rothschild's role in the creation of the Israeli state, but particularly in being an extremely powerful figure behind the scenes, sacking BBC director generals and even being involved in, as Peter Wright talks about in Spycatcher, the appointment of director generals of MI5 and MI6, etc.
This is during the Cold War. Surely the Russians at that point are saying, well, you know, we want nothing to do with these Israelis. They're our enemy.
Well, they were. They were easing out of it because Stalin was long dead and his henchmen were long out of it. So they had no reason to support Israel. But don't forget, Rothschild was still there. Victor Nathaniel Mayer would have been saying, well, we believe the state should be upheld. And he would have been doing that quietly on the side. It wasn't a major event for him after Israel, but he definitely had some influence. But yeah, of course, and the Americans have, because of the very powerful Jewish community, have kept that state running. It's interesting at the moment, though, whether they've pulled off a coup or not with all those other states supporting Israel and becoming friends, quote unquote. Very interesting time, actually. All the other peace accords have fallen apart, and we don't know what will happen under Biden if he is actually elected, because he is in the pocket of so many people, particularly the Chinese. So, and Syria, under Erdogan, is a very dangerous state. You have to know the history, and the history was that it was liberated. Syria was liberated in 1918, and I know this because I've written a book on it. 100 years later, the Turks want the Middle East back. They want it back. So watch this space. They've already got a foothold in Syria at the moment, and they are determined to take it back. It's only 100 years. It's a very short time in history. They controlled, you know, they were a huge empire in Europe. They had that taken away, and then the last bastion was the Middle East.
So this is the, hang on, this is the Ottoman Empire you're talking about.
Yeah, of course, and they want it back. Just watch what's happening. So there's going to be a very interesting development there with all the Arab states lining up to support Israel at this moment, whether the Turks will then say, well, wait a minute, we don't agree with this, we're going to go in there. So it'll be a different kind of confrontation from the past, because the Turks are so aggressive and want it back. It's a simple thing. It's only 100 years. They were utterly humiliated by having that area taken from them in the Middle East War, in World War One. Utterly humiliated. Terrible moment. Ataturk pulled them around and, you know, made it an interesting development as a republic. That's all over now. The Muslims have more control and they will want the Middle East back. That's my point.
And let's get back to Victor Rothschild again, though, because he did also play a very important role behind the scenes in politics, including things like having a role in appointments of the Director Generals of MI5 and MI6.
Yeah, he had enormous weight, because what people would do, and I don't have this chapter and verse, but I know that this sort of thing happened. People would go to Victor, not knowing, of course, about even when he was challenged by MI5 and interrogated. It was interrogations, the word, but in fact, they were asking him what he knew about Burgess and Philby and McLean and all the rest of them. He wasn't actually pinned down as a spy himself. They suspected something, but they thought, no, it can't be because he's Lord Rothschild. So people would come to him and say, well, do you think that Joe Bloggs or Jenny Bloggs should be MI5 director? And what do you think about the Inspector General? Should it be this one or that one? And he'd say, yeah, he's a good chap. We should have him. He would be contacted more than anyone else. Why? Because he was on the inside during World War II in MI5 and was connected. There's no one bigger in your history, your recent history, certainly in the 20th century, than Victor Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild in terms of his influence.
So he was officially or unofficially head of vetting everything?
Yeah, he was, because look at the prime ministers. Even the very bright Thatcher did not know, was not informed that there was a deal done to keep Blunt in the tent with the royals. She wasn't told. It was a shock, because MI5 were rulers, as they call themselves, of the universe. In other words, when there's a continuity of government for 30 years, that's different. But when you've got the civil service running things, because a change of government, Labour, Conservative, Labour, blah, 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 you go on forever, the monarch stays in the same position, you have the situation where there are stabilities like Rothschild. He's gone to. He has the influence. How would someone like Wilson, even Wilson, Heath, they don't know what's happened inside intelligence. They don't know anything. They have to be told who by MI5 and MI6. So they're the ones that do the bidding. I mean, yes, Minister is the most brilliant portrayal of what actually occurs in British government or government anywhere with the civil service.
I love that. They don't know anything. There's people like Callaghan, Wilson, etc., Martin. And I think, you know, you can kind of corroborate that a bit with our experience with particularly with David Shaler and Annie Machon when they were MI5 officers, and Annie running things like counter-surveillance in MI5. And they didn't know anything about Operation Gladio, nothing about it at all, even though it was actually out there in the public domain. So the whole, I suppose, take-home of what Roland's saying about Victor Rothschild's techniques, really, is playing on people's ignorance. And that's what I suppose we try and do with journalism, is to just get some of that stuff out into the open.
Well, it's pretty obvious that if you are the intelligence services in any country, you're going to be in a very powerful position. James Jesus Angleton, who was head of CIA counterintelligence, basically, you know, he had his own personal room at Langley, Virginia, with files, and it was paper files in those days, and he basically had files on everybody else in the CIA. So he basically ran the show from behind the scenes.
But you know who he trusted more than anybody else in British intelligence?
I've no idea, but I mean
his name is Kim Philby.
Well, yeah, but the thing about
Angleton was absolutely devastated when Philby was
In other words, you're only as good as your last game, and if somebody else is on the inside is working with the other side, then Victor Rothschild, from what you're saying, was working for the Russians. But of course, he
one of the things Ronan says in his book, Martin, is that Stalin was getting information before Churchill was about the British attack.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, it's quite clear that what they called the Red Orchestra in the 1930s, the Soviet intelligence services were probably the best in the world. And it was because they were able to infiltrate Western. I mean, Harry Dexter White, who was Keynes's interlocutor at Bretton Woods, and in many ways they were the architects of Bretton Woods. But it's quite clear that Harry Dexter White was working for Stalin. We know that now. The point is that when you're at that level, Victor Rothschild is working for Stalin, but he's also just working for Victor Rothschild.
Well, he's also working for the creation of the state of Israel.
So he's actually working for Mossad.
The key thing, I suppose, I understood reading that book, The Fifth Man, and actually chatting to Roland Perry, lovely, lovely guy, amazing person to, you know, great respect to him, to a privilege, really, to interview him, was this whole concept that during the Cold War, it was absolutely crucial to keep the Russians on side with the Israelis, because the Russians saw Israel as a massive threat to Soviet interests. And Victor Rothschild managed to do that because of all the cachet he'd earned through World War II.
Well, I think what happened there was, if the Soviets had said they weren't going to accept a state of Israel, it would have been very difficult to set it up.
I'm thinking particularly through the 1950s, 60s, 70s, through the Six-Day War, etc. You know, seeing the Americans backing up the Israelis in the middle of the Middle East, the Russians, you know, would have had a pink fit, surely.
Well, no, and what gradually, I mean, at that stage, when the State of Israel was being set up, the people who didn't want it, as he says, were the British. The Americans were wavering. I mean, Truman didn't really want it, but of course he was put under a lot of pressure by the Jewish lobby, if we can call it that. And the
Zionist lobby?
The Zionist lobby, yeah. The Soviets could have said, we don't want this.
We're in a position to say we're not having it.
Yeah, they were in a position to say we're not having it, but they didn't, which is a very big... And the Czechs provided a lot of the military equipment for the early Israeli army.
Anyway, it's an absolutely fascinating book. A final clip with Roland Perry. He talks about journalism today. I asked him about, you know, what tips has he got for young journalists starting out in the profession?
It's changed dramatically since I was in it. There is no real journalism. It's all propaganda, left and right. It's propaganda. Now, I shouldn't say don't do it, but be aware that your integrity is going to be tested straight away because it's so partisan. I mean, it's hideous. Everywhere, it's split down the middle on whether you're left or right. So people go in for the propaganda element. If you're on the left, you propagandize and the journalism suffers. The integrity suffers. As soon as you go into propaganda, whether it be Russian, Nazi, American, doesn't matter. That's bad. So journalism is, I mean, when I went into it in Australia and in England, there was an element of integrity involved. It doesn't exist. It's which side you're on now and who you're propagandizing for, sadly. And I'm still in it. I'm still writing. I'm writing a lot of books, of course, and I occasionally do a bit of journaling, but really it is a different world. So you've got to buckle up and not... And forget ideology and try and go in hard in the middle. Maybe it'll swing back, Tony, and there'll be a sudden revelation of, oh, what about the truth in something? Would that be, what about balance?
What about balance? That would be nice, wouldn't it? And interesting that, you know, I think he's also, we had quite a nice chat there about, you know, the role of Victor Rothschild in destroying journalism in this country by getting rid of Alistair Milne and putting John Burt in charge of the BBC and starting to make moves towards privatisation, putting all sorts of very peculiar characters into senior management roles, as John Burt did after Victor Rothschild moved in on Alistair Milne, Martin. And of course, Alistair Milne's son is Seamus Milne, who was famously Jeremy Corbyn's Director of Communications.
Yeah, I mean, we know what's happened. The BBC have been, neutered, effectively. And don't forget, they never were entirely an independent journalistic exercise. I mean,
I track that, and so does Dennis Potter, actually, back to 1987. And basically, it's during the Thatcher era where you've got a director general who's trying to do balanced journalism and he's just basically shot in the head.
Well, not shot in the head the same way as the Mossad officer, but yes. I mean, I think to a certain extent, the idea that there's a golden age when journalists were independent and it's all gone down the drain since.
I just don't think you're taking on what Roland or I are saying, that that's the idea of standards in journalism have slipped horrendously, partly through the arrival of Rupert Murdoch and others, but largely through the fact that the BBC are no longer setting a benchmark that they did back in the 1980s. I mean, at least standing up to governments to be an independent broadcaster.
I think we're talking about degrees rather than absolutes here. There is a degree of objectivity and
well, there's no balance
journalism
whatsoever, well, as we were discussing earlier, the idea that this Pfizer vaccine may be, for example, the very first ever vaccine that's editing people's human genes. This would be seen as rather potentially worrisome and therefore is not discussed at all. We've got the introduction of massive taboos into our mass media now.
There are massive taboos if you are the BBC, but on the internet, people can say whatever they like. And of course, the Brigade 77 is operating as we speak, funded by the government, to rubbish people who are criticising vaccines, to create false conspiracies, for example. One of the techniques intelligence services use, they know what's going on, so they then create a conspiracy which is similar to what's going on, but crucially different. And then they feed
easily discredited. Yeah.
So that it's called poisoning the well. And all of these techniques are there. The GCHQ, which have been accused of going into schools in Gloucestershire.
They have been going in.
I mean, the point is that they've admitted that they've got these various techniques, including, you know, pretending to be people they're not, creating denial of service attacks, essentially aggressive cyber warfare. And of course, there is no justification in my mind for intelligence services, you're supposed to be collecting information about the real world, to engage in aggressive cyber warfare.
I think it's also worth mentioning that you can become be trained as a British Army psychological warfare officer, work for Brigade 77, then get a tap on the shoulder and saying, how would you like to work for an extra zero on your salary for Strategic Communication Labs, Black Cube, or the private sector?
Yeah. Well, that's what goes on. I mean, there's a huge, I mean, the CIA doesn't really exist anymore. It's a series of shell companies. Lots and lots of different private, and all of these people have got security clearance. But of course, and the other thing you're talking about, Annie and Dave earlier working for MI5, another thing about any intelligence work is you only know what you're supposed
to
know.
And we're talking here really about the death of journalism, not a diluting of it, but where most important facts are actively kept from the public.
I think there's plenty of good journalism going on, Tony, but it's not available to the mass. Some things like World in Action and Death on the Rock, which is probably one of your most successful.
It won awards and it lost Thames TV their franchise.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you can't make films like that which are going to be shown in prime time. And don't forget, there were only three channels in those days, so you've got one in three chance of getting whoever's watching the television. So it's a paradoxical situation where, in actual fact, there's lots of very good journalism going on. Whitney Webb, for example.
I wonder though,
they just don't have the platform. Whitney gets a pretty good
audience anyway because of people like us shoving her stuff out there as well. But I wonder whether we've saw the death of at least the fatal, possibly fatal, certainly injury of the BBC in 1987 by Victor Rothschild and Marmaduke Hussey. But maybe the same sort of thing is happening to the internet too.
Well, what's happening on the internet is that the intelligence service, various vested interests, including intelligence services, are working on the internet round the clock. I mean, you know, there are troll factories which are employed by the Israelis, for example, where students sit on the internet all day being paid money to intervene in forums to discredit those who criticise the state of Israel, paid for by the Israeli government, which, of course, ultimately is paid for by the US taxpayer, because the state of Israel is essentially a welfare state.
Anyway, it's called The Dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. It was a seminar put together by Global Vision 2000, an Islamic think tank, which is an annual eschatology seminar that they do. And I was invited. I put a presentation together for half an hour. But I thought it would be interesting to hear the introduction to that seminar, which was, or at least part of it, which was put together by a chap called Moeen Yassin. The idea of the actual the title of the conference is Eschatology 2020 Plandemic, the Dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. So let's have a listen to part of, anyway, of the introduction by Moeen Yassin.
So the title of the Eschatology Roundtable this year is called The Plandemic. I think everyone gets a message that, from a global vision perspective anyway, we do not, indeed we've had a 3 hour or a couple of hours internet interview with some American Muslim scholar explaining that, that the concept of the plandemic, not the pandemic, and then the global reset and the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order and preparation for spiritual warfare. So that is the theme this year. And it builds upon previous events last year, like Jerusalem, Jesus, Imam Mahdi, Dajjal, coming kingdom of God, then World War III scenarios, future of humanity the year before, and the year before global nuclear war and future of humanity, and before that, eschatology, interfaith, compared perspectives. So what I want to say as introduction for this year and before the first speakers is that Global Vision 2000 is pleased to organise this sixth eschatology roundtable that we've done. And also, dare I say, for the first time ever on the Zoom platform. And hopefully this is a breakthrough, if it goes well, to reach a global audience. Already there are good signs with a person, Wajdi from Jerusalem, and David from Canada already. So the main thing I want to say just now is this event, virtual event, whatever you want to call it, is taking place at a time of unprecedented changes, which is hurtling the world into uncertainty, dare I say chaos, and turbulence. Since last year's eschatology roundtable, the world has changed. That's not rhetorical. It's changing all the time. So what's changed? Well, something called COVID-19. And in its wake, we've had lockdowns connected to the same event or phenomenon. And with that has come social distancing, masks, and God knows what else, bubbles. But that has now in turn led to an economic meltdown. And by definition, that will lead to a financial and monetary crisis. And the UK alone, according to the media, or some media reports, it's been said it's the worst recession in not 30 years, but 300 years. It's not my analysis. It's in the media, that report. And talks about a 20% contraction in the economy. Obviously, depends which source you take. And this has led to, not my term, a global reset. Where did that word come from? World Economic Forum. A guy called Schwab, is it Schwab? Yeah, someone will give me the full name again. There is also a build-up of war, basically, globally. We monitor this, and I'm sure some of you too, but there are various flashpoints in the world right now that are actually in a state of war or ready to go to the next stage. And that includes places like the South China Sea, the Indo-China-Pakistan border, Indo-China-Pakistan-Afghan border, and then the Middle East, obviously. And dare I say, Europe's not going to be scot-free. Russia and NATO. the other point I want to make is, we can discuss this, is a global coup d'etat happening? By who? By dark forces, from my perspective, who are busy during this so-called lockdown. Certain people aren't under lockdown. They're, it's like me controlling this Zoom meeting. Whilst all these lockdowns are happening, there are certain people, what's the word, moving joysticks to move the world in a certain direction. So my question, just posing it out loud, is there a global coup d'etat by dark forces who are centralizing power, authority, control, and wealth happening? A practical illustration of that is, why is Amazon, I hope the figures I'm given is correct, at a time when small businesses are being, what's the word, an elephant, an ant scenario, when small businesses are being crushed like ants by an elephant, why is Amazon just in the UK hiring 2,000 people per week? Is that a coincidence? Why have I brought in the notion of spiritual warfare? Well, under this pandemic, which I've just argued, how come all religions, their temples, churches, mosques, gurdwaras were closed under this pretext? And in the Islamic case, because I believe Islam is going to be singled out, how come the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage in Mecca, Medina, in my view, was closed down? The Saudis gave the fig leaf, oh, we're allowing 1,000 people to do it. Well, you get 2 million people, mate. By mate, I mean King Abdullah, who normally come. You normally have, Sir, Your Highness, Your Majesty, 2+ million people coming from all over the world, and you claim that the Hajj was still allowed by 1,000 people? That is a misnomer. I would argue an Islamic eschatology talks about this, that the Hajj will be abandoned. I will argue that under the pandemic, spiritual warfare has started. How come the annual duty for universal brotherhood, for upholding the God of the worlds, was sabotaged, was abandoned this year? That is a fact. That is, if that's not spiritual warfare, I don't know what is. I'm just about to finish. And also, if you link that to the sanctity, like in France, the Prophet Muhammad being a focus of cartoons again, you know, mockery of sanctity. Muslims do not mock Moses, Jesus, or whoever. But in France, the mockery, of sacredness and sanctity of the Prophet Muhammad is deemed to be upholding freedom of religion. Really? That's obviously led to uproar in the Muslim world. So if that's not an attack on spirituality, I don't know what is. I think I've said my piece. And the final comment I want to say is that it looks as though the Dajjalic, which is really means satanic, world order, new world order, is developing weaknesses in not just the Islamic spirituality and tradition, but all spiritual traditions. You know, people, it's difficult for them to pray, yeah, to put it crudely, and practice their faith, so, and come together to worship the Lord of the worlds. And it looks as though, and I've said this from a global vision angle anyway, I believe the Dajjalic system, which controls the world, wants their man to come out in the open. That whatever's been happening in the shadows, because it's the end time. They want their man to come out in the open, like an emperor. Yeah, if you don't want to use the word antichrist or whatever, I think the notion of an emperor, you know, a world ruler, they want him to come on his stage. And they want to build a temple. That's why Jerusalem's important. They want, you know, they want him to have his palace. A palace, to use a secular term, a palace. They want to install a god emperor. That comes from the Roman tradition. A god emperor. He's actually going to say, I am God. Some of you might laugh at that. Well, we'll see. We'll see who has the last laugh. So that is my perspective from a global vision angle. And that's why the situation we face as humans from all traditions is a battle between good and evil. And the world right now is being divided into those two camps.
So that's Moeen Yassin there. Fascinating, I think. Is the actual conference or seminar conference that he organised is called the 2020 Plandemic, the Dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order. And he's bringing together people from different traditions, monotheistic traditions, all based on the Old Testament Bible and the God of Abraham, Isaac and Joseph. And basically pulling together different ideas of the whole different ideas of the end of the world from those different traditions. Fascinating exercise, and monotheistic faiths all coming together. That is to talk about the Plandemic. And we'll be doing some of the excerpts from some of the other talks. David Livingstone was one of the contributors, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And Clive Menzies was another one who's was involved in Occupy and has done something called a project called Critical Thinking, all involved. And we'll be having hearing some of those over the next few weeks. We'll be having a couple of weeks off over Christmas and the New Year, unless anything big happens. We will can jump back online and find us here. Time to sign off now, though. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to local geopolitical analyst Alan Brown, and also studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can hear this show on radioquk.com midday on Sunday. And you can also talk to the people from BCFM and ask them if our show can go back on air, which is what I shall be doing this week as well. Sunday evenings at 6 over on BCFM, you'll hear the glorious tunes of Danny Lopsch. So do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming. Freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming. Freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming. Freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Oh yes I know, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Oh yes I know, oh yes I know, oh.
Freedom is coming, oh yes, I do.
Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, oh yes, I do. Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, oh yes, I know. Oh yes, I know. Oh yes, I know. Oh, Jesus is coming, oh yes, I know. Oh yes, I know. Oh yes, I know. Oh, Jesus is coming, oh yes, I know. Freedom is coming. Freedom is coming. Freedom is coming, oh yes, I know. Freedom is coming. Freedom is coming.